If life weren't easy for me, about the driver who lives inside my head. Sparks me up and stops me and puts me into bed. He opens up my mouth when it's time for me to talk. It fires up my legs when he wants me to walk. Keeps my eyes open most of the day. Adds to my memories the things that people say. When he makes decisions, I don't have to wait. But sometimes it seems that he's got too much on his plate. Like this morning when I woke up and he dressed me in this shirt that looks a little ragged, where he dragged me through the dirt. I'm moving through this life and I'm thinking about the next, and hoping when I get there I'll be better dressed. Keeps my eyes open most of the day. Adds to my memories the things that people say. When he makes decisions, I don't have to wait.
Hi everybody, we're live. Oh, I interrupted
we
the best fish song. That song, I sing that song to
Bouncing
Adam.
Around the Room?
No, Driver. That's my good night song with Adam. It's fun. Anyway.
I'm surprised you didn't give me any snark for that.
Nah.
I'm both proud and disappointed.
Actually, I taught, well, my son learned a valuable lesson tonight. We were eating dinner at the table, and I had some jam band music playing by Goose over the speakers.
You? Surely not.
Yeah. And he said, "Can I put my music on after this song?"
Oh, no.
You know what the kids call that, Marco? Let's see how tuned in you are to your, tween now, right? The tween lingo. What is that called?
I don't know. What is
I
it?
Have no idea.
Well, in case he doesn't know, his kids are too young. All right. Well, I'll leave it as a mystery to you.
I need to know now.
I'll let the seven young listeners... Everyone who listens to our show is old like us, I feel like, because when I say things like this, no one chimes in and is like, "You old dummies, it's blank." So this is a test for people. I don't know. Should I do that? I don't know if we want a week's worth of follow-up.
No. Just let her rip. Let her rip. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to give just a brief moment of silence that Overcast will inevitably strip for everyone to think about it. And then, John, you can go ahead and tell us the answer.
We should give the chat room. Give the chat room a chance.
The chat room is just making fun of us and suggesting "You Old Dummies" as titles. So.
Yeah, they don't have any idea either. They're all old like us.
There's got to be some young people in the chat room. I'm going to give them a few seconds. Marco will just cut this
how
out.
How many young people know how to use IRC?
Chat room, young
to
people in the chat room, what
podcast
is it called? Adam, Marco's young son, wanted to be able to play his music through, presumably through the speakers or whatever you're listening to. What is that called?
isn't that just called being a kid? Like, doesn't every kid want to play their music instead of their parents' music?
There is a modern slang phrase for that.
I'm assuming DJing is not the answer.
Do they even know what DJs are?
They don't know. It's
we have a 23-year-old who doesn't know, a 35-year-old who doesn't know.
No one knows.
37-year-old is all fogies. Listen, you're in an IRC channel. Let's be honest. You're probably pretty old.
An IRC channel for a podcast. Like, let's be clear. Like, this is not a young person's game here.
Yeah.
Hit the aux, suggests somebody in the chat.
There you go. Somebody knew it.
Oh, okay. So
you,
I can
Adam
them.
Asked you to put him on aux.
That's what
I have
they
never
call
heard
it?
That before.
And now, so, you know why? We, as olds, we know why they call it that.
Right.
It's back in the old days when you had an aux input in a car, right? The auxiliary input. It was headphone jack that you could plug an audio source into in your car and it would play. Or like in any, like in a stereo system, there'd be a headphone jack that says AUX on it. And that's, you plug in a Walkman or an iPod or whatever. So they say, put me on aux. It means give me control of the thing that is playing music so that I can play my music through it.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the time of the Walkman did not overlap the time of the aux jack very much.
It did. The aux jack, you'd buy those stereos. I had, you know, you'd buy those stereos with dual cassette tapes in them so you could copy cassettes, and they had an aux input on the thing. So you can put the Walkman into the aux input and then record on the cassette.
But John, you're missing Marco's point. It wasn't a Walkman because you are even older than us. And normally that doesn't make a big difference, but in this one particular circumstance, it does. It would be a Discman or Discman.
No,
or whatever
I'm saying it went as far back as the Walkman. Mm. The one with the cassette tape in it.
I mean, anyway, existed back then, like on stereo equipment, but you would never have one like in a car or any kind of speaker.
No, they were in cars still. Yeah, back then, it's just
in the era
jack.
Of portable cassette players. They were aux jacks in cars. I don't think
why
so.
No, that doesn't make any sense to me. Why would they be? I really
they
think
came out
right.
so you could
play from your cassette player through the car stereo.
No, but the car stereos cars had cassette players.
If you had a car that didn't have a cassette deck, or if your cassette deck was broken, or if you just wanted someone else to be able to control it.
Cars that were so early or low-end enough to not have cassette decks also wouldn't have had aux jacks.
Anyway, aux jacks are not universal because I remember lots of my Accords didn't have them and I had to add one through a stupid header thing. So I'm not saying that they were commonplace, but they did exist. It's literally just a headphone jack.
Are you really pulling an Infinite Timeline-style argument on us now?
No, I'm clarifying that they weren't common. And
I mean, the funny thing is, like, aux jacks actually did not have a very long era of popularity in cars because they were mostly added during the late stages of the iPod era and in the early stages of the smartphone era, but then Bluetooth took over pretty effectively.
Well, no. Hold on.
My cars still have them. I mean, I know my cars aren't that old, but at 2014 and 2017, they both have aux jacks on them.
Well, but Marco, you skipped a step. You are broadly correct. But yeah, they started becoming a thing during the iPod era to me. Yes, John, I'm sure a few cars had it before then. But realistically, the aux jack became popular during the iPod era. And then, yes, there was Bluetooth not too long after. But you're skipping the USB, like, what was that term? It was like an iPod
like the dock protocol.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a couple of years of that. And
don't forget the FM
point.
Adapters. Those were so bad.
Well, those were early.
They were.
And cassette adapters were actually pretty good.
Yeah, cassette adapters were better than FM, but only barely.
Oh, no, they were quite a bit better. They were
quite
almost
a
perfect line in. Like I
had bad luck with the cassette adapters in terms of them being reliable and continuing to function, and they sounded bad. And yes, FM sounded bad too, but...
FM was way worse.
Very close to a real line in, because the way they worked is actually very clever and extremely simple. And
they kept breaking and flaking out.
No, we had one for
no
literally like
parts.
20 years.
How did they? Yeah,
maybe it was the wire. Maybe I just wasn't like the little skinny wire that would dangle out of the thing. Maybe it was the cassette tape part and the stupid the way it clipped into the thing. I don't know. I just had really bad luck with them. And FM adapter things I also had bad luck with.
Well, those were always garbage.
Because Honda didn't have aux jacks forever. That's why I had to add them to my 2004 Accord. I had to remember that I opened up the whole dashboard and wired in the aux jack.
Mm-hmm. I did that.
Anyway, kids knew it from the iPod era. Like kids who say this, I assume they picked it up because when they were kids, they had an iPod and they wanted to hear it in their parents' old car, and their parents' old car had a thing for iPods to play through. And so put me on aux, continue. And I bet a lot of people are using that phrase today who have no idea what it means because, you know, once it goes into the lingo, you don't really question it.
Well, it's not like something that, like, put me on aux. If that's the actual phrasing they are using, like, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it doesn't. It's slang.
And also, like, how would the parent connect the kid's phone themselves? Like, wouldn't the kid have to, like,
take
the cable?
Let me go on aux or whatever. Like, ask Adam if he knows this phrase.
I will.
Send him a
message.
Is
he awake?
Send him a message now.
No, I'm not doing this now. Anyway.
Oh, boo.
So he
real-time pop. We need it.
No, Okay, hold on. Adam.
Oh gosh. Hey, while Marco is paging Adam, you know, I was looking up a Wikipedia link for the show notes, and I'll give you one guess what happened in Chrome just now.
Come here. We have a question for you.
Okay.
All right.
Hi.
Hey, what's up? All right. They want to know, are you familiar with the phrase, put me on aux?
No.
If you wanted to...
Oh, no.
If you wanted to put... if you wanted me to have you put your music on the speakers, is there a phrase you would use for that?
Can you put on my music?
That's very straightforward. Thank you, son. You've proven my point.
That is what I would say. Yep.
Yeah, because that makes sense.
I'm going to go play Forger now.
Okay.
Yeah, right. I guess.
We have our follow-up. You're wrong.
It is a phrase. It's just Adam doesn't know it yet.
Yet. Anyway, thank you to Anti Composite, the 23-year-old in the chat room with the rest of the old people who got us across the line on that, or got the two of us across the line.
Yeah, people are suggesting it's also past the aux or I'm on aux. Yeah, there are many
so
variants.
Weird. Anyway, so the lesson he learned earlier was when he did not ask to be put on aux, but when he instead asked, could he play his music over the speakers after my song was over? He has a jam band, Dad, and my song was 35 minutes long.
Jeezy, cheesy.
And it was halfway through. It only had like 17 minutes left.
Only.
Oh, goodness.
And so I'm like, yes, sure. We agree to this. And then I told him like a minute later, by the way, there's 16 more minutes left in this.
He should learn to be tech savvy. He's like, can I just glance at the now playing screen on your phone to see like where the progress bar is maybe? How many minutes are left?
Well, it would have looked, it was right in the, and thanks to our modern iOS design, you know, everything.
It doesn't tell you time remaining.
It does, but it's the tiniest, dimmest text on the screen.
He's got good eyes.
Yeah, and on the Mac, of course, it would require hover, but, you know, on iOS, we don't have that luxury, so they designed it away into tiny little low-contrast text.
Yeah. All right, let's get started. Let's do some follow-up. John, you have received your notes export. It came via carrier pigeon, I'm quite sure. What was the result?
Disappointing. So it was 337 megabytes, which I thought was promising. I'm like, oh, this must have all the stuff that I want. And what I got was a whole bunch of folders, which I think were basically named after like my notes folders, kind of. And in those folders were .txt files, plain text files. So all of my like, you know, bold headings, all of my styled text, all of that gone. All of my links mostly gone or expanded into plain URLs. And then a bunch of image files in subdirectories below that. So wherever I placed those images in the document, however I scaled them or cropped them or did anything with them, all that is also gone. So this is not a faithful reproduction of the work I put into each one of these notes, right? Like, for example, I was looking for my one about sofas, right? There's just a text file with a bunch of text, and there's kind of like blank lines between sections of text where I know that images should go, like this image goes with that, but also the images are like as I originally downloaded it from web pages before I crop them and everything, so you can show smaller portions. It's just it's not great. Like, it's better than nothing if you really wanted to have a backup and like, oh, I really want to have that important text that was there and those important images, but it does not preserve the rich text nature of notes, which is a shame. Because remember, this is Apple's own export. I know there are tons of utilities that will do this for you, that will try to preserve it, that will try to make an RTF file out of it, that will make a PDF out of them. But Apple should really up its game here. It's great that they offer a text file and images. Like, I don't object to that being an option, but it's not a backup of all of the work that I put into my notes.
Indeed. James Anthony writes, the potential overlap between Apple's Car Project and Apple Vision Pro with regard to spatial computing could be huge. How about this? Instead of making a massively expensive, high-stakes, fully autonomous robot to transport human beings safely across Earth, try developing a robotic product at any size or price point that can transport anything of any size or weight, any distance inside of my own home or office. Despite the advances in cameras and AI and robotics, in 2024, there still exists no consumer product at any price point capable of moving from room to room, locating a physical object, and manipulating it. Nothing that can go press a button or turn a knob or open or close a cabinet, drawer, lid, door, or window. Nothing that can hide dust or fold laundry or check on and feed your pet, let alone make you a sandwich or bring you a beer. Hearing the car project people getting reassigned to the AI team makes perfect sense to me, and I'm glad to hear it. You know, this reminds me of, I can't remember the name of the thing, but there was this little like orb of a robot that I think I saw advertised on Instagram a lot that would follow you around. And the theory
Jeepo
was,
or something. What was that?
I don't remember. You know what I'm thinking of? And I think it was mostly meant for city dwellers. And I don't mean that derisively at all. But it was meant for city dwellers. Like you're in New York City, you go to like your local bodega or whatever, or maybe, you know, local grocery store, and you're only picking up a few things and you put it in this little pod that follows behind you.
Oh, yeah.
And it will follow you home and so on and so forth. You don't have to carry your groceries. And it was both the most ridiculous and dumb thing I've ever seen, and I wanted one immediately.
It's not Jeebo, right? I just put the Jeebo link in the chat room, but what you described is not this, I'm assuming.
I've seen that, though. I think it was on like college campuses or something. I don't remember, but yeah, I saw this.
They do have a lot of delivery robots on college
campuses. No, Jeebo is not what I'm thinking of.
We talk about delivery robots on Robot or Not a lot, that deliver food from place to place.
Oh, that's what
I
heard about.
Yeah, I do know what you're thinking of.
It was probably on Robot or Not.
Yeah. So, on this topic, this is actually somewhat relevant, mostly because of Elon Musk. Like, he's got that one of his many ridiculous things that he thinks he's doing is like, we're going to make a humanoid robot, you know, that whole thing. Yeah. And he had the person come out in like a lycra suit and say, this is what it'll be like, but robot.
ridiculous.
The interesting thing about robots, like household robots that do more than like a Roomba, you know what I mean? I'm not going to say the smarts part of it is not hard, because it is, but surprisingly the main barrier, as far as I can tell, is the boring parts. What cars have going for them is we figured out the thing about making a machine that you can ride inside that travels from place to place on roads. Like we figured that out. You put wheels, you have brakes, we have traffic controls and signs and roads that we've paved and we plow them. It's like, you know, we've got that part sorted out. Now we just need something to drive them. That turns out to be really hard, right? Inside the house, for a thing that you're going to buy for, like, you know, like a Roomba type level of device, I think the moving from place to place and doing useful things is actually, like, we're not even over that hurdle. Like, that is the first thing that you have to do before you get to the point where, okay, now technically we have something that can do that. Now put in the smart so it, you know, does something useful. Because to make anything that can move around your house and do useful things, even if it's just like getting you something out of the fridge, requires an amount of mechanical machinery that probably pushes the price of this too high to be useful in the market. Like Roombas could be better if they cost 10 times as much. You can make a you know, house cleaning robot that is a lot better than a Roomba, but it would be so much more expensive. They really have to control costs on that. That's why it's so limited, right? That's why it's like, why can't you just make it go up and downstairs? We can make robots go up and downstairs. College kids do it all the time. It's not hard. It's just expensive. And I think that is actually the difficult barrier, making a cost-effective thing that can traverse your home and grab things and transport them. And if you somehow are able to do that, then it's like, okay, now how do you get it smart enough to do that without like killing your pets or, you know, doing other terrible things that it can do? Like, I'm not saying it, you know, it's easier than self-driving because the stakes are lower, the speeds are lower. If it knocks over a drink instead of bringing it to you, oh, well, it's not that bad. You know, it probably won't kill your pet because you just make sure it's really weak and can't actually kill a pet. But
depends on the pet.
The hard part of this, I think, is actually the robot for not too much money part. And so I would suggest Apple not go into this business.
It doesn't seem like it's exciting enough for them, you know? And I don't think there's much of value to extract from the car project to apply to that kind of thing. By the way, did you? I don't know if you saw yet. A couple hours ago, Mark Gurman published this giant feature story in Bloomberg.
Yes, I was going to put that as the fourth topic.
Yeah, all about the like, just detailing all sorts of insider info about the car project over time, like all the different, you know, phases they allegedly went through, you know, angles they allegedly tried to, you know, and how they allegedly.
Yeah, and
tried
by the way,
it.
I think everything that was in that article had been leaked before, but this is more like confirmation, just reminding you now that people are willing to talk. All that stuff was more or less true, because I remember reading about all those things individually, but individually you're like, really? And now all together as a summary when the product's done over, I'm like, okay, I kind of buy it now.
Yeah, it just seems on so many levels. First of all, I didn't know all that stuff. I knew about half of it, I think, already. So a lot of it was news to me, at least. And there's a lot of like commentary woven throughout about, you know, from different sources, people who had allegedly worked on it. But it was really something to see, you know, what was basically a decade of this of this failed project, like all the different phases it went through, what they thought they wanted at each point, different partnerships from different companies that ended up falling through for whatever reason. And it just, it seems, there must be such a big story to tell there, and we're only getting a little bit of it. But it seems like such a mess. I can't, it's kind of shocking as an Apple fan to see like how long they, you know, wasted away for so long on that project, for how much money and how much talent, all for what seemed to have begun as a Johnny Ive vanity project. And didn't
I don't know.
Really
it's not Johnny Ive vanity project. Although at one point they said they, according to whatever their source was, that they considered buying McLaren because it would make Johnny Ive happy. It's like, talk about a bad reason to do something. He's becoming disengaged with the company. He seems like he might leave. We should buy McLaren because he likes that. Then he'd have a car design studio in the UK. It's like, no, don't buy a company to satisfy your super important person. Like, that's. I'm glad they didn't do that. But
oh yeah.
I don't think it was a vanity project for him, but like the problem is, you know, we'll put a link in the show notes to the article. I think you need a Bloomberg subscription to read it, but like,
or Apple News.
There you go. They had a bunch of different ideas, and we talked about this. That's why I didn't want to cover it this week, because we kind of covered the car project, and there's nothing really new to talk about with really the project. But this kind of outlines the whole, like, it should drive itself and not have a steering wheel. Stuck around for a really long time, and there were proponents. Obviously, there were strong, influential proponents of that strategy inside the company, and only towards the end, when the rumor came out, they said, "How about not?" And we just put a steering wheel in. And that was like, you know. 8 years into the program, right? And as we said, it turns out they couldn't make the car without the steering wheel. And by the way, all of their ideas of how of what the car without the steering wheel should be like, I think would have been disastrous. Like, this is one thing I didn't get to talk about when we talked about the car thing, of like, that I think Apple has vastly underestimates and also has no idea how car styling works. Like, car styling is such an important part of making cars, and it is deadly and fraught and way more difficult than I think Apple realizes. All of their ideas were pretty bad. Like, granted, we just see sort of vague rumors or whatever, but I think it shows a misunderstanding of what makes people buy a $100,000 car or an $80,000 car, or hell, any car. Car styling is so dangerous and so complicated and so culturally enmeshed. Like, it's so easy to get wrong and so hard to get right. And I think Apple would have just disastrously blown it. Obviously, if the car drove itself, no one would care, right? But they couldn't do that. So if they fielded a regular car and they tried to style anybody, Johnny Ive, anybody at the company, like, the only way it would be okay is if they got just actual car people from car companies to style it and didn't let Johnny Ive anywhere near it. But every time I hear the descriptions of the Johnny Ive influence car, I'm like, yeah, nobody with that much money would want that.
And by far, my favorite little tidbit in this story was that allegedly Johnny Ive wanted to offer the car only in white, which is the
white
best
interior
thing ever.
White interior, serious? White cloth interior. Have you ever been in anything?
Oh my gosh.
And white wall tires.
Yeah, the white wall tires I did see. I only read like the first third of the article, and the white wall tires, I was rolling. Like, what is this, 1950 all over again?
I mean,
again?
Look, like,
of course, Johnny
had
to go to New
back
England
in
winter.
Back in style now. Like, you never know.
God, mullets are
it's
back.
It's time
it's
for
so
white
gross.
Wall tires to come back. Like, it's every time, every like 25-year-old man I see now has a mustache and a mullet. It's a very strange thing to
I
see.
I don't understand it.
Sidewalls are so small now that white wall tires would just look like a white, like, pinstripe on the tire.
So true. All right, let's move on. Matt Johnson writes, I keep hearing tech people, including ATP, talking about Apple Vision Pro, saying various things indicating that Apple's ideal and eventual form factor for the Vision Pro is a pair of glasses. This seems logical, but it also seems like many of the touted features in this version one are dead ends. Theater mode, immersive environments, and more all seem to rely heavily on a fully controlled VR environment, even when they are mimicking AR, that I think that any glasses will always struggle to provide. Maybe these are just features that sell the current product until Apple can get where it wants to go. And when it does, they're no longer important anyway. We've also had plenty of other devices that have been that have tried to attack the problem from the AR side first. The X-Reel, Rokid, Ray-Ban Meta, etc. have all tried various things, albeit with less polish than Apple can provide, and they've barely registered notice, and when they have, it's often received ridicule. For example, the way ahead of its time Google Glass. So are glasses actually the end goal, and how can Apple Vision Pro get from here to there? Would working from the other direction, even with Apple's polish, have been a bad idea? And I've been thinking about this a bit, in part because of Matt's feedback, and I've been thinking about it from hearing similar things from other people. I can't help but wonder if there will eventually be two versions of the Vision Pro, and, you know, whatever the naming may be, that's mostly irrelevant. But like, one of them is completely immersive like it is today, and one of them is a more sleek, more AR oriented thing. Because Matt's right, like, some of the best things to me about the Vision Pro today, anyway, are when it's fully immersive. Watching a movie in it is incredible. Looking at panoramas are incredible. You know, it's incredible to do that. Some of those things, to Matt's point, would not be better with a more glasses-like form factor. So I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of fork this thing, for lack of a better term, and go two different directions concurrently, because you might want to be immersed, say, on a plane or something like that. You might want that, or if you're watching a movie, or you might not want that if you're around family or in the real world or whatever the case may be.
Yeah,
I don't know, John.
It seems like the Vision Pro, what we know of it today, is not like the glasses imagined version of this that's just glasses. It's not like that's close. Like, if you look at what the Vision Pro is today, all the different challenges it faces, especially just in terms of physical realities of, like, the batteries required, the computer hardware required, all, like, yes, a glasses version would have different requirements. Some of them would be lesser, like there was no screen, obviously. Well, no traditional style screen. There's some kind of projecting something in there. But we are so far from that that I think it would have to almost be two different products. Because if that was actually their end goal for this product, we wouldn't even have this yet, because we're nowhere near that. It's a totally separate thing. The same. It's probably almost like the difference between an iPhone and an Apple Watch. Like, yeah, those are both based on a lot of the same, you know, core components and some of the shared software underneath it. But an iPhone and an Apple Watch do a lot of very different things and are designed very differently with very different capabilities and different priorities. And similarly, like, the, like, clear glasses version of whatever Vision Pro, you know, whatever AR glasses that would be, that would have so many restrictions on it compared to anything that can have any kind of bulk to it, like a headset. It would be a very, very different feature set, and way, way fewer of the current Vision Pro's features. And I think it would be more like an Apple Watch in the sense that it would do a small number of focused things that can be done within a very, very tight power envelope. And that's not at all what the Vision Pro is. The Vision Pro is a whole laptop on your face. Like, there's not, or maybe a whole iPad is a little bit better, but these days the line is blurred. But the Vision Pro is doing very, very different things with extremely different classes of hardware and classes of size and weight. So we're talking about different products at this point. Whether they can ever actually do those, like, clear glasses thing, who knows? But I don't consider what we see the Vision Pro today, I don't consider that even in the same lineage as AR glasses, because think about how many things are different. Like, first of all, there's no closing out the world visually. Like, you can't. So there's a big problem right there. That takes out all of the most popular features so far with Vision Pro, which is mainly about immersion and movie watching. Like, those would both be terrible on clear glasses. It would also have an interesting challenge of, like, well, how does it see your hands? Well, where do you put all these cameras? You know, the Vision Pro right now has, what, like, six cameras on it or something? Where do you put all those on glasses? And then where does the power come from? Where is the hardware? Where is the computational hardware? Is it just in the stems? There's not that much space or weight available there. So, like, there's all sorts of major challenges. I don't think it's the same product at all.
Yeah, so the reason everyone talks about glasses in the context of Vision Pro, partly because that was one of the rumors, and partly because Apple has always talked about AR so much, and with respect to AR, obviously clear glasses solve the pass-through problem, because, hey, you're looking at the world. It also solves the giant heavy thing on your face problem, the seeing people's eyes problem. Like, tons of problems that Vision Pro has are solved by the glasses form factor. I do think that it is the same lineage. If you look at some of the existing devices that are essentially glasses that you can see through that also have images they can project on them, HoloLens does that. What was the... Not Magic Cap. That was the Newton people. Or not Newton people. Whatever. What is the other one called? Magic Leap. I think the X-Real thing. There's a bunch of, like, sort of... Ray-Ban has, like, kind of cheapish glasses that you can buy that stick a bunch of electronics in the stems, as we call them, but they're actually called the temples, so we always forget that and just call them stems, right?
Oh, I was going to say sticks, and I knew that was wrong. I'm like, oh, yeah, I think it's called stems.
Temples. Anyway, some of them have wires that go down or whatever, but, like, there are a bunch of products that do this. Obviously, the screens in them are terrible, right? But anyway, you can that's why this person says, hey, people do that and they haven't really caught on. It's because the screens are terrible and because they're not actually as slim as you want them to be. The reason I think it's the same lineage is you're going to need to do a lot of the same things. Setting aside where you hide the cameras, and I think there are clever places to hide them, especially if they get much, much smaller or whatever, you still kind of have to solve a lot of the same problems with augmenting reality, right? By painting things over the real world in a way that is useful. You know, having the computing, working on screen tech. Granted, it's different screen tech, but it probably is vaguely related. If you look at the existing ones in the market, they don't, you know, they all use kind of screens that kind of project themselves into your field of view. The way I would think about it in a future when it actually is possible to get something decent looking in glasses for $3,500 or whatever, is that it's the necrorobotic core, right? If you have the glasses and they can show, you know, high-res, bright stuff like Vision Pro can, that is a subset of the block out the world. If you have those glasses, it's pretty easy to put a thing over them that now makes it immersive, because now you put the whatever you would call it, the light shield, let's say, over it, and now you've blocked all your vision except for the screens, which presumably would fill even more of your field of view than the current Vision Pro does, especially if they're like wraparound type glasses or whatever. And there you've got your immersive VR Vision Pro experience. And maybe that the light shield thing has additional sensors for pass through or whatever. But like, if you can do the glasses, you can do the VR thing. And I don't even think they need to be separate products. If you go naked robotic core and say this is the smallest it can be, but if you want the immersive experience, add this thing onto it to essentially block out the rest of your vision. Blocking out your vision is pretty easy to do. It's all the other stuff that's hard. So I don't think this is anywhere close to being here. And Matt's question about, like, should Apple have started in the other direction? I think the answer is definitely no, because everyone who started in the other direction has sort of aimed to be, like, inexpensive, lightweight thing that you can watch movies on in, like, 1080p in a kind of dim way with poor color reproduction. That doesn't wow anybody. I really would not want to use like my max virtual screen inside one of those things. The resolution's too low. They, to Marco's point, they don't have any cameras or sensors for hand control on them or whatever. It's not close enough to be useful. It's not anything impressive or useful now. It's way more or less expensive than $3,500, but like Vision Pro, at least what it has going for it is it does impressive things. It does things better than anyone has done them. And it fits into Apple's ecosystem. Using your iPad apps, controlling your Mac, it's trying to be useful today as opposed to just saying, oh, if you're on a plane, you can watch not great looking movies and not great looking screens on these glasses that look like really bulky glasses. The Vision Pro says, if you're willing to put this giant thing on your face, we can look way better and we think you'll like it. So I don't think they started from the wrong direction, but it's going to be a long, to Marco's point, it's going to be a long time before they can do the glasses even as well as Vision Pro. And by the time they can, the Vision Pro caliber $3,500 thing that you stick on your face is going to be even better. So it's not going to be within the next few years, so just, you know, be patient.
Yeah, and that's important too, like, to point out that, you know, as the technology gets better and more miniaturized to do maybe those, you know, the clear glasses down the line, everything else will also get faster and better, and the resource levels will go up and expectations will go up. That's why, even though the Apple Watch has now been out for almost 10 years, right? This is the 10th year, I believe. So the Apple Watch has been out for almost a decade, but it hasn't replaced phones. And the current trajectory is for it not to replace phones, you know, effectively ever, probably. And the reason why is because our expectations of what everything does and what technology is able to do with a given amount of space and power goes up over time. And so while the Apple Watches today might be as fast as the iPhones 10 years ago, and you know they might have a lot of the same kind of hardware capabilities at the raw level as phones 10 years ago did, our phones are now that much better. And when you apply more power and more space and more money, so
and also the watch's screen is still roughly the same size.
Sure,
like that's the biggest limiting factor on the utility of the watches. It's just so darn small, and it's on your wrist, and you can't use it with two hands.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. Those are like physical form factor restrictions that will always keep the watch a certain amount behind the phone in terms of hardware capabilities. Well, the same thing is going to apply with these two types of eyewear. You know, the headset versus the glasses.
They're both things in front of your eyes, though. Like
they are, but the headset is always going to have way more space and weight budget in it for things like a bigger battery or higher computational power components. Whereas the glasses will always need to be lighter, smaller, you know, thinner, like everything.
Yeah,
everything
but what they both have going for them, though, is like the watch is limited by its form factor because it's a watch and human wrists aren't really changing size. And the fact that we only have two hands isn't really changing rapidly. But putting things in front of your eyes, eventually, you reach the limits of human perception. Audio quality in the music we listen to, not that it is the best it could possibly be, but it has reached a point where pursuing better audio quality for our consumer audio is not fruitful. Screens are getting close to that for like desktop screens, like Retina is, you know, I think they could go a little bit farther, but you're pretty close to exhausting in terms of resolution. We could do better on color and brightness, but like we're getting close to limits of human perception. So for the VR thing, once the $3,500 thing or whatever equivalent is starts to reach the limits of human perception in terms of resolution, then the AR glasses can essentially catch up because there's no sense in going higher resolution. There's still, you know, light field cameras and being able to focus your eyes. There's always another frontier to jump to, but there is a reasonable point of equilibrium because they're both competing to put screens in front of your eyes. So I think there will be an area where there is overlap between them until the next breakthrough comes that requires a $3,500 thing.
By the way, while we're on this in our Vision Pro corner, I discovered a new pro and a new con for Vision Pro usage this week. The con, which kind of goes along with what John was just saying, is in movie experience, I miss the subwoofer. Like when you watch a movie with a decent speakers and a subwoofer, you get those awesome like low bass sounds and parts of the music and everything. And in the Vision Pro, since it's all headphone based, you don't get that no matter what you're wearing because headphones
just
don't really
put your Vision Pro on aux. Hook it up to your stereo system. Send the sound through your home theater system, which has surround speakers, of course. Oh, no. Well, at least you have a subwoofer.
Sick burn. Wait, real quick, though. Are you using the audio pods? You're not using, like, AirPods or anything like that?
Well, I tried both. But the thing is, like, headphones. Look, I love headphones. I'm a huge headphone nerd. Headphones in general do not have the kind of low bass response that subwoofers have. They can't. Like, it's just, you run into physics problems. Even like the very best headphones that have the very best low frequency response cannot reach as low as a subwoofer.
You're not going to feel that rumble in your chest.
Exactly. that is part of a good movie experience, in my opinion, for many movie types. So I do kind of miss that. The pro I discovered is that the Vision Pro is the first computing device that I've ever used that I can use while I have moisturizer or other lotion on my hands without it like gumming up the screen. Like it's winter, my hands are always so dry, and usually I like before bed I like put moisturizer on my hands, and then I'm like, well, now what do I do?
Like, I gotta like wait for it to dry. Be careful touching the things the glass that's in front of the cameras though.
But you don't have to touch it. You put the Vision Pro on and then you put the moisturizer in your hand and then you can sit there and let it dry.
Take it off.
Yeah, well, by that time it's dry.
All right. I'm not a moisturizer person. I don't know the parameters of the moisture problem. But I'm like, oh, yeah, I wouldn't want to touch electronics with moisturizer either. But because you have to touch the Vision Pro on like the glass and aluminum part. You can't grab it by the light shield. So anyway.
Look, John, not all of us are oily like you are. Some of us need a little
I'm like that all the time. I'm not putting anything on. It goes on all my devices.
Hey, you don't need moisturizer.
I don't use it.
All right, let's move along. Let's talk about the semi-breaking news. There are now M3 MacBook Airs. There are series MacBook Airs.
Before we get, German had a rumor right before this broke that he was saying, hey, there's not going to be any March event for Apple stuff that they're releasing, iPads, Macs, etc. And shortly after he posted that, sure enough, MacBook Airs came out and there was no event for them. When he first posted this, I'm like, really? No event for the first redesign of the iPad Pro in 6 years or whatever it's been? But since Apple press release, you know, released the MacBook Airs, maybe they don't want to have an event for, like, I just feel like for the iPads, I would think they would want to explain stuff, but who knows? So far he's one for one, M3 MacBook Airs, no event, just a press release.
Yeah, it was surprising. As someone who is not a huge MacBook Air fan insofar as I don't, that's not a computer for me. I have nothing, there's nothing wrong with it. It's great machines and phenomenal machines. It's just not for me. So I don't have too much to say about this other than there was a very brief gate, if you will, very, very brief kerfuffle about the fact that it is stated in the, I guess, press release or whatever, that it now supports up to two external displays, which first of all, heck yeah, that was one of the biggest complaints I saw of the M1 and M2 MacBook Airs, that they only support one external display. And that made a lot of people really, really crotchety.
Although,
and
when you saw it, Casey, didn't you think, wait a second, I remember as one of the hosts of ATP that we had many discussions about how the M3 system on a chip cannot support three monitors. And why the M3s don't, you know, like the limitations from the M2 haven't changed.
Yep. That's why I was like, I was poring over the tech specs right afterwards. I'm like, how did they do this? I'm like,
right,
how is it different from the 14-inch M3 MacBook Pro?
Right. We talked about it so much. It was like, we had a whole thing of, I guess they just decided that for the M3, they, you know, they're sticking to what they did in the M2 and you can't have three monitors. Right. But the answer to that was eventually evident.
Yeah, so they say that the only way you get two external displays is if you close the lid on the MacBook Air.
Ta-da!
So you can clamshell it to get two external displays. And honestly, I don't think that's an unreasonable trade-off. Like, obviously, in a perfect world, you would want to be able to do three displays, you know, one, the onboard and two externals. But, I mean, that's what the other chips are for, and we have a little bit more information about this. But suffice to say, one external display up to 6K at 60 hertz, so you can drive your beloved XDR display. Or you can close the lid to get two 5K displays at 60 hertz. And I think that's pretty decent. I think that passes muster for me anyway. But how is this working? So Hector Martin, who is, I think, basically the primary, if not only, developer of, what is it, Asahi, something like that? The
Asahi?
Something like that. Thank you. The Linux that's destined, the Linux that is destined for the Apple Silicon Macs. Hector writes, Apple introduced this capability into the M2 already. What? It's why the M2 Mac Mini supports two displays over Type-C or Thunderbolt, while the original M1 Mac Mini does not. The laptops are logically equivalent to a Mac Mini with the HDMI port hardwired to the internal panel. Whoa. The only reason this wasn't enabled on M2 laptops so far is that it requires extra firmware support to disable the internal panel and reconfigure the primary display pipe for external mode. The firmware has lots of special support for the internal panel, so it's not, quote-unquote, just another screen connected to the system. And there's a lot of stuff that has to be done properly to make this work as intended. Now the question is whether Apple will backport this to the M2 or not. DCP firmware nominally has an identical interface synced between all platforms, so it should be a common code base, so it should be easy to do. But they might explicitly lock it out. Today I learned.
Yeah, so this makes perfect sense, because obviously we've known the M2 can support two displays, so that's just because it doesn't have a built-in one. And of course, the MacBook Air supports two displays, the built-in one and one external one, and so allowing it to ignore the external one makes sense. As for this being backported to the M2, this definitely smells like something that Apple wouldn't bother doing unless they essentially get it free, as Hector was saying, like, look, if it's a shared code base and they just update the firmware, everybody gets it. And related to that,
so there was a brief window of time, several hours, where everyone was losing their mind, and mostly understandably, that, hey, there's a 14-inch M3 MacBook Pro that exists in the world that cannot do this. It's not the M3 Pro. It's not the M3 Max. It's just the straight-up M3 MacBook Pro. It can't do this. What the what? Well, Apple get on the horn with 9to5 Mac and says, we're going to backport that. So Apple's confirmed to 9to5 Mac that a software update for the 14-inch MacBook Pro will gain the ability to drive two external displays with the lid closed. This feature will work identically to how it works with the new M3 MacBook Air. We don't know yet which software update.
Of course, that's also an M3. So the question remains, will it be backported to M2? And even if Apple sort of gets it for free because it's like a shared firmware base or whatever, it kind of strikes me as one of those cases where Apple might be like, you know what? It's a good differentiator for the M3 models to be able to do this in the M2. Not people who bought the M2s bought them without an expectation that they would have this feature. Even if it's technically possible, I do wonder if Apple's going to bother backporting it. So I'm glad the M3s are all getting it. I'm glad they essentially backported it to an M3 product that existed before the M3 MacBook Air. I think this is a good compromise. I do continue to hope that in the M7 or whatever the hell timeline allows them to make changes based on feedback, they will say, you know what? two display controllers in the M3 line might be limiting, not for desktops, but for the laptops, because, I mean, we'll see. We'll see how people like the M3. Like, people are annoyed, like, when I dock my laptop at work, I can't use my two monitors. Well, now you can. Are you happy now, or are you still annoyed that you can't also have your lid open and use the built-in display? And, you know, as we pointed out when we looked at this, when we were originally discussing this, why did they not make this change in the M3? The display controllers take up space on the die. They cost money. This is the lowest-end M chip. How do you want to spend the money and that space and that power budget or whatever? It still might be the right thing for Apple to do on its lowest-end laptops to only support two, but at a certain point, as transistors shrink, I think they should spend some of that bounty of additional transistors to put maybe another display controller on there.
Indeed. So some of the features that are a little bit different for audio: voice isolation and wide spectrum microphone modes, and enhanced voice clarity in audio and video calls.
Who do you think that is? Do you think that's just like software using the M3's better neural engine? That doesn't strike me as hardware differences.
That sounds a lot like, because they've done similar tricks in the past where they're like, the webcam got better, and it's like the same component, just with better software and image processing. So,
and why would it be M3 as opposed to M2? Like, the M3 does have a better neural engine. You know, like, I don't know. But anyway, there's not a lot of differences, so we're reading you all of them.
Indeed. Connectivity moves from Wi-Fi 6 to Wi-Fi 6E. And with regard to the environment, the new MacBook Air is the first Apple product to be made with 50% recycled content, including 100% recycled aluminum in the enclosure, 100% recycled rare earth elements in all magnets, and in another first for Apple, 100% recycled copper in the main logic board. MacBook Air meets Apple's high standards for energy efficiency and is free of mercury, brominated flame retardants, and PVC. Packaging is 99% fiber-based, bringing Apple closer to its goal to remove plastic from all packaging by 2025. Well done.
Every product they come out with, it's nice to see, like, they get new stuff to brag about to show that they're making incremental progress towards their goals, which is nice. There's one more important feature that the M3 MacBook Airs have. It is, quoting from Apple's documentation, available in Midnight, which features a breakthrough anodization seal to reduce fingerprints. Remember that coating that the black MacBook Pro has got? This makes me think that the Midnight one is getting that coating too, which will really help, because the Midnight one looked awful when anybody touched it.
The M2, not the M3, but the M2 13-inch MacBook Air is still for sale, starting at $1,000. This is in comparison to $1,100 for the M3. The M1 MacBook Air is no longer for sale, brand new.
Sad. The M1 MacBook Air is gone because, you know, basically the M2 replaces it in the line at the same price point. I'll miss the wedge. I think there was a Verge story about specifically missing the wedge, but I think we've all mourned this when the MacBook Air was redesigned. But I still think that M1 MacBook Air is so great. Obviously, it would have been better if it had MagSafe, but you can't have everything.
Yeah, this honestly, it had a great run. The M1 is pretty old now. It was time to let it go out of the lineup. So I bid it a fond farewell. I loved that computer. It was extremely important and amazing. But yeah, it's old now, so it was time to bid it farewell.
And also, I was consulting with some people about, like, should I buy this? You know, someone was asking, like, I want to buy a cheap laptop. What should I get? And I said, well, you should get an M2 MacBook Air, but the M3 is going to come out soon. And this was, like, weeks ago. Lo and behold, the M3 did come out. But what I said was, like, look, the M3 is going to come out, but it's not better in any ways that you care about, probably. So wait for the M3 to come out and then get the M2 cheaper. And you can do that right now. Like, I don't know how long they're going to sell the M2. Maybe, you know, just like they did the M1 for the entire duration. But you can configure an M2 for up to, like, several hundred dollars cheaper than you used to be able to configure it a couple days before. And are you going to notice the M3 differences? Maybe the dual display thing, if they don't backport it, if that's important to you. But the speed difference or anything like that in this class of machine is not going to be impactful to you. The battery life, Apple's rating them exactly the same. This is a good time to get a cheap M2. Maybe towards the end of this year, then the M2 will be a little bit longer in the tooth. But right now, you can get a good deal on an M2 MacBook Air, and that's a good machine. And if you swapped out someone's M3 MacBook Air with an M2 one and they didn't use two external displays, how long would it take them to notice?
Yeah. Well, it depends on whether they get the navy blue model or not.
The fingerprints would show up.
Yeah. No, but that's great. Because, again, like, the MacBook Air, it's so important to hit low price points with that computer. And so to have now, you know, the M2 version has all the modern stuff. You know, it has the MagSafe, it has the new design, it has the new finishes, all the stuff that the M1 version didn't have. And it has all that modern stuff. It's not that old, and now it's that low-priced option. That is fantastic. So I'm very happy to see this. It's exactly what this line needs. I love the MacBook Air line. I still use one. I have an M2 one that I use for bouncing around the house and occasional transport. And it is just a delightful computer to use. It's amazing to pick up and hold and bring places. It is a great all-around computer, and it is by far the default choice for almost any needs. If somebody says, I want a computer, you can just say, get the MacBook Air. Unless you know specifically that they have some really good reason why they can't get their work done on a MacBook Air, that's the default for everybody. And it's great that it got better, and the low-end model got better, and it's just great news all around.
Yeah. Speaking of great news, no, actually, what's the opposite of that? This is like a category that's been a category in this show and a category in the news for, it seems like, years now. I guess we would call it Apple versus the world.
Seriously. All right. So Apple was fined approximately $2 billion. That's billion with a B, billion dollars, by the EU for App Store practices. This is covered in The Verge. From The Verge's summary, Apple's been hit with a fine of 1.84 billion euros, or about $2 billion, by the European Union antitrust regulators over its App Store rules, and has been told it cannot stop music services from advertising cheaper subscription deals outside of Apple's store. Apple issued a scathing response to the ruling, which I'm sure we'll talk about, saying the commission failed to, quote, uncover any credible evidence, quote, of consumer harm or anti-competitive behavior. The company also says that Spotify wants to, quote, rewrite the rules of the App Store, quote, to gain competitive advantages while paying nothing to Apple, despite Apple claiming the App Store was crucial to Spotify's current market domination. Apple says it will appeal the decision. I think, maybe I'm reading this wrong, but the thing that struck me so funny about I think it was from The Verge, the summary from The Verge, but the way they wrote it just stuck out to me. The quote is, this decision sent a powerful message. No company, not even a monopoly like Apple, can wield power abusively to control how other companies interact with their customers. And it's just so funny to me because this is an example of like Apple's perspective leaking into The Verge's coverage of it. Is it really?
Who do you think they refers to, though?
Well, that's the thing. That's why I said maybe I'm misreading it. But I read that as, this is Apple yet again saying these are our customers. They're not Marco's customers, your customers, and my customers for, call sheet and Overcast and whatnot. It's Apple's customers.
Yeah, I think your read is right for looking at the sentence again. Yeah.
That's gross, man. That's so gross.
Well, but, I mean, that's the way Apple always frames it.
I know it is.
I forgot to give my framing of this. I got too distracted by Apple versus the world. I do want to talk about, just to summarize, this is a specific ruling and Apple's going to appeal and blah, blah, blah. And the news here is like the fine is bigger than they thought it was going to be because there was a leak that it was going to be like $500 million. Turns out it's $2 billion. And we'll talk more about that in a second. But I do want to sort of give the overview of this because I think it is instructive and kind of sketches the outline of this whole debate in a way that is easy to miss because of all the details that we're going to get into. This is the European Union, we've said this before, but reiterate, deciding that there's insufficient competition in certain markets and they want to increase the competition. And I know this sounds stupid, but bear with me. In the U.S., people are in the U.S. we're familiar with, you study history or social studies class or whatever, the Sherman Antitrust Act, the idea that there's only one company in the United States that can sell cars, that's bad for consumers because if you don't like the cars from that one company, you don't have a choice where to buy something else. And you're like, well, someone will just start a competing car company. That's capitalism. But then if you try to start a competing car company, and of course, car companies get all their parts from this part supplier network. And you're like, I'm going to buy, you start a new car company and you go try to buy tires from the tire company. And the one big car company says, hey, if you sell tires to that startup, we're not going to buy any of your tires anymore. And you're going to go out of business. That would be an example of abusing monopoly power, right? And we have laws against that. That's what the Sherman Antitrust Act is about in this country, to say if there is what we call in a monopoly, one big giant company that controls too much stuff, it's bad for consumers. For exactly that reason. And it's not illegal to be a monopoly, but it is illegal to say to the tire manufacturer, if you sell tires to any of those startups that are trying to compete with us, we will cut you off and you will go out of business. That's abusing monopoly power, right? The EU says there's insufficient competition in, smartphones or whatever, however they define the market there. But in the EU, they don't have the same rules as we do about, like, there needs to be one big giant company that is overall dominant. They've decided that Apple and Android as sort of a duopoly with two companies more or less dividing up the entire market for, like, smartphones, for example. It doesn't matter that, you know, neither one of them is the only game in town. It's like, well, if you don't like Apple, you can go to Android. And if you don't like Android, you can go to Apple. See, competition. The EU has decided that's not enough competition. So everything they're doing is based on that theory that there's not enough competition, and when there's not enough competition, it's not good for consumers. More specifically, there happens to be a few important companies in Europe, like, say, Spotify, that obviously lobby them and have a vested interest in saying, you know, Apple is being real unfair to us on their platform, and we don't like this, and so on and so forth. That's kind of details, though. I just want, you know, the big picture is, in theory, not enough competition according to the EU, and their rules are different than ours, and they want to find a way to make more competition with varying degrees of success. And I think keeping that in mind helps to frame this not as, like, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, who's right, who's wrong, Apple should be able to do this, why can't Apple do what it wants with its customers, is the EU being mean, is the EU being good? Like, you can have your opinions about it, but what the EU is trying to do makes sense if you understand their worldview. From a U.S. perspective, it doesn't make, like, you just read in that thing, like, that Apple, was this quote from The Verge? No company, not even a monopoly like Apple, the thing that you just read,
Yeah,
Casey?
I'm pretty sure it was from The Verge, yeah.
Right? A monopoly like Apple. An American reads that and says, Apple's not a monopoly. Like, in the smartphone, in no market is Apple a monopoly. Like, they don't have, like, 99% smartphone share. They don't have 99% share of, like, even, like, AirPods. Or, like, they're not a monopoly. And it's like, that's not, the EU doesn't care that they don't dominate. The EU cares that they're too big, right? That, you know, there's no, like, percentage market share, percentage profits, or whatever they said. It doesn't matter that they're not the only game in town. There's too few games in town. There's not enough competition. And we read that and saying, that's unfair. Like, I've said this in the past, trying to say, you know, according to US laws or whatever, it's like saying Honda has a monopoly on Honda cars. I mean, they do. It's kind of tautological, right? But it's like, but there are other car makers, right? And the EU has said there's not enough. There's not enough competition. And so we need to make this playing field more level. Gruber had a post about some of the things we're going to talk about today as well, saying, like, well, what is the EU saying? Who should decide who gets to, like, do things on Apple's platform? Shouldn't Apple get to decide that? Is the EU saying they should get to decide it? And my answer to that is, yeah. That's what they're saying. They're saying, you, Apple, because you're too big, and Android and whatever, we are going to impose rules on you. Even though you made the platform, it's your company, you did the thing, and in your American sensibilities and your American concept of monopoly, you say, I should be able to do whatever the hell I want. I'm a private company. Who is the government to tell me who I can and can't allow on the App Store? If I say Spotify can't put a link to alternate payment methods, it's my platform. I make the. If they don't like it, they can go somewhere else. And the EU is saying, that would be fine if there was more competition. But there's not, and so we've decided we're going to impose rules on you. And that, I think, gets lost in a lot of this discussion. I mean, I feel almost like it kind of got lost in Gruber's thing of, like, him not even understanding what they're saying. It's like, yeah, that's 100% what they're saying. That's their whole point. Not enough competition. Government steps in to, in theory, restore competition for the good of consumers. Now, are they successful at that? Like, the DMA, we don't know how that's going to work. We talked about it in many past shows, but we have some questions, and same thing here. But I do want to just put this long-winded framing up front to put everyone in the right mindset of, like, what's happening in the EU and why.
Yeah, we've talked about this so much, and I don't know that there's much more. Well, of course, there's much more to say because it's the three of us, but I'm trying not to go down the rabbit hole that we find ourselves in so much about Apple's attitudes towards third-party developers. But I mean, I'm not upset by this, to be honest with you. Like, I feel like the more I read about it, the more maybe it's a little more narrow than I want it to be. So let me read some excerpts from the EU's actual press release about it, which, to the best of my knowledge, is the only real documentation we have so far. But the EU press release reads in part, Apple is currently the sole provider of an app store where developers can distribute their apps to iOS users.
This is them essentially saying Honda has a monopoly on Honda cars.
Yeah. The commission's investigation found that Apple bans music streaming app developers from fully informing iOS users about alternative and cheaper music subscription services available outside of the app and from providing any instructions about how to subscribe to such offers. These anti-steering provisions are neither necessary nor proportionate for the protection of Apple's commercial interests in relation to the App Store on Apple's smart mobile devices and negatively affect the interests of iOS users who cannot make informed and effective decisions on where and how to purchase music streaming subscriptions for use on their device. So
pause you here on this, by the way. This is them essentially, like, they're not saying this, but the implication is that, look, users don't have a choice to go elsewhere. If you assume users are stranded on iOS, like there's no real choice for them to go elsewhere, which we know is not true. They can go to Android, but they're basically saying, like, there's not enough choice, so that your normal answer of saying, hey, whatever we do on our platform, man, they don't like it, they can leave. The premise of this is that they can't make effective decisions on how to purchase streaming music or whatever. Yeah, they can't do that on iOS because of Apple's rules. But why do they have to be on iOS? And the EU is like, it's too much, man. Like, there's only two companies, and they both do very similar things. And so the out is not for Apple or Android to say if they don't like it, they can go to our one competitor. The EU says, just assume they're stranded. Given that they're stranded, given that, like, they have no choice, like it's like the public airwaves, like there's only one set of public airwaves or whatever, there's only, you know, air pollution, there's only one atmosphere for all of us, right? There's only one iOS for all of us, and Android and iOS, and we all have to be there to live our lives. This is why the EU has decided there's insufficient competition on these two important platforms. They're dispensing with the notion that there is any real competition and that people can make choice. And they're saying, given that people are essentially trapped, again, I know they're not, but that's what, given that people are where they are and realistically there's nowhere else for them to go, we have to make sure that this place where they're effectively trapped is fairer than it is. And that, I think, is really interesting because, again, when Apple looks at this, they're like, what the hell, man? It's our platform. We should be able to do what they want. And the EU's like, well, given that people are stuck on your platform. I was like, well, how are they stuck on our platform? They can just go to Android. And Android does the same thing about Apple. And, like, honestly, it's not the way we do things in the US, but I see their point of view, and I also see how a duopoly is, especially with respect to the Sherman Antitrust Act and our monopoly laws, having a duopoly like Android and iOS is a very convenient, like, kind of get out of jail free card according to US laws. If it's like, we're not a monopoly and never will be, so now if we and Android more or less do kind of similar things, that's competition, right? And we all know, like, we all have to have mobile phones. And there's, like, there's no place for us to go except for the other company that does exactly the same thing. So I kind of do feel that there's insufficient competition in this market.
Yeah. And just to quickly reiterate and recap, the issue, or at least the way I understand the issue, is that Apple forbids, generally speaking, forbids people from saying, hey, if you don't want to buy our thing on the App Store using an app purchase or whatever, go to, you know, www.spotifyischeaperontheweb.com and we'll sell it to you there for less money, because the implied thing there is we're not paying 30% to Apple. And Apple has made it very plain since I can remember that that is forbidden. That's the anti-steering thing. You are not allowed to steer your customers, not Apple's customers, your customers to your own website in order to establish a relationship with them. You're not allowed to steer them to your own website in order to sell at a cheaper rate than what you would sell on Apple's platforms. None of that is allowed, and that's the crux of the issue here.
Yeah, if Spotify doesn't like it, they can just get off the iOS platform, right?
Isn't that
a perfectly viable thing for Spotify to do? What's the problem?
100%. I don't know why they're whining.
That's what it'd be like, you know, maybe there's a better analogy, like instead of users being trapped, like that's not an option for Spotify. Just stop selling to 50% of the population. What's the big deal, Spotify?
Right. In setting the level of this, continuing from the press release, in setting the level of the fine, the commission took into account the duration and gravity of the infringement, as well as Apple's total turnover and market capitalization. It also factored in that Apple submitted incorrect information in the framework of the administrative procedure. Womp womp. In addition, the commission decided to add to the basic amount of the fine an additional lump sum of 1.8 billion euros to ensure that the overall fine imposed on Apple is sufficiently deterrent. In addition, the fine must be sufficient to deter Apple from repeating the present or a similar infringement, and to deter other companies of a smaller size and with similar resources from committing the same or a similar infringement.
So interestingly, the EU didn't like Apple's behavior. Like, they didn't seem very cooperative or nice, and so they punished them for it. Keep this in mind for a future topic.
Mm-hmm. The commission has also ordered Apple to remove the anti-steering provisions and to refrain from repeating the infringement or from adopting practices with an equivalent object or effect in the future. Dear Apple, get fucked. Love the EU. I mean, I again, like I.
Well, I don't know if $2 billion is a see, I'll do it nicely, is a get effed response, because Apple might be like, this annoys us, but we make $2 billion in start the stopwatch. Like, it's not nothing. It's not nothing, but Apple makes a lot of money. So I do, like, it's so hard to figure out what is a deterrent versus what is, like, you know, what is the amount that makes Apple leave the EU versus what is the amount that is too cheap for Apple to notice. I think this kind of hits the right level because Apple seems pretty annoyed about it, but I'm not sure it deters Apple from anything.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah, I mean, I don't... But, I mean, keep in mind, though, like, it, you know, the amount the European Commission is, you know, assigning as a fine seems arbitrary enough that if Apple does just blatantly say, all right, fine, we'll pay it and keep doing what we're doing, they can just then find them a lot more next time.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't think they're going to keep doing it. I think they'll... I mean, because a lot of the stuff... This is part of the debate on this, is this is a previous ruling that is superseded by the DMA, which doesn't allow, has disallows the anti-steering thing anyway, which is part of Apple's response.
And I expect we're going to be debating, and they're going to be going through court for years on whether their DMA response is compliant with the DMA or not.
I don't know if that's a court for years thing, but we still don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be, you know, I assume Epic's going to fight it. We'll get to that in a bit. We're going to, I assume Spotify might continue to kind of lobby against it in the background.
Yeah, no, there have been many people filing briefs essentially saying, hey, we saw Apple's response to the DMA, and we, a company that's out here, thinks it's totally not compliant. Just for what's that worth? For what that's worth, go ahead, European Commission, and tell us whether it's really compliant.
Yeah, and then we have, you know, what hits home here for us is we have Apple continuing to tell this, you know, storyline to themselves and the press and the courts and the world that effectively says that developers bring nothing to the platform, and that we owe Apple for all of our business, and that we provide no value to the platform. That certainly, you know, the iPhone doesn't need Spotify. Spotify needs the iPhone. The iPhone doesn't need any of our apps. The iPhone would sell itself without any apps whatsoever. And you know, we are just sucking on the value that they're providing, and
I don't think Apple has ever said that. That's how you feel, and that's how a lot of things that Apple says in that direction. But Apple has never. I'm going to be fair to Apple. They've never come straight out and said that.
No, but that's basically their argument here, and it, you know, and in their response to this, they really lean on that pretty heavily.
Agreed.
And by the way, this response
is something. It is something. All right. So
first of all,
a few excerpts.
It's terribly written. Like, whoever wrote this, it had to be a very high up executive, because whoever wrote it didn't get edited enough. And so it had to be somebody so high up that they couldn't get edited enough. And so this is, whoever wrote this should not be writing things for Apple's press release.
Like, in a future topic, we have some things that Apple wrote that actually have names signed to them. So you can tell me if you think it sounds like the same person.
Yeah, no, this, right. I'm telling you, this, whoever wrote this, it's poorly written. It sounds juvenile. It sounds petty.
Oh, God, yes.
Like, it is... I wonder, the whole time I'm reading this, I'm wondering, who is this for? Like, who are they writing this for? Is it for the public? Because it's not a good look. Is it for regulators? Because I don't think they need to write, like, press releases to regulators. I don't know. Is it to courts? I doubt it. That's not really the venue for that either.
I think it's to the media.
Who is it for?
I think it's to the media.
Did they think this would make them look good, though?
It's the reason we have this link is because every single article that talked about this linked to Apple's response and quoted it. So that's what it's for. There's going to be stories on this fine, and Apple wants to have its say on those stories, and this is Apple's say.
Apple should not have this say.
I do think
both
of you are right.
For their own good, they should not be saying this in this way.
I don't know how well a job they did, but that's the target audience, I believe.
No, I think you're both right. I think Marco is 100% correct that this is extremely petty, extremely juvenile, extremely vindictive. You know, somebody in the chat room just said they're acting like a petulant child. Couldn't agree more. But I also think that John is right. The purpose for this is to have some sort of official statement for the press. So let's read a few excerpts. Today, the European Commission announced a decision claiming the App Store has been a barrier to competition in the digital music market. The decision was reached despite the Commission's failure to uncover any credible evidence of consumer harm and ignores the realities of a market that is thriving, competitive, and growing fast.
On the consumer harm, again, from an American perspective and the various laws and cases that have been on things like this, they're usually pretty well-defined things that you have to show to be evidence of consumer harm. Very often in U.S. law, it's fixated on prices. Has the price of X gone up or down over time? And if the price hasn't gone up, then where's the harm to consumers? Obviously, we know, and I think most people involved in these cases know, that consumer harm can take more forms than just, you know, high prices, right? Lack of choice, things that consumers never even get a choice to pay money for because they're disallowed. All of that is harm that is not as simple as saying, hey, look at the price of this thing has gone up. That would be such a ham-fisted way to do it, like the Amazon model of, like, we'll put everyone else out of business, and once we have a dominant market share, then we'll just crank up the prices. That's like a, you know, evil pharmaceutical bro level of, because that has happened to pharmaceuticals, right? But and it's like nakedly evil. But like the smarter strategy is just to maintain your dominant position, reap your good margins, and not kill the golden goose by suddenly jacking up the prices 1,000% or whatever. So Apple's saying there's no consumer harm. I think the whole EU thing says, like, look, here's what we consider consumer harm. They don't have a choice. The Spotify can't explain a better deal to them. And yeah, like the prices may be the same or lower or flatter, not changing that much, but there are many other ways to judge harm. So this is a place where Apple and the EU essentially disagree, or Apple is being disingenuous and saying, we don't see any consumer harm, show us the consumer harm. The EU is like, we're trying to show you the consumer harm, but it's not as simple as look how the price has gone up.
If you took your fingers out of your ears, maybe we could talk to you about it. Anyway, going back to Apple's response, Spotify has a 56% share of Europe's music streaming market, more than double their closest competitors. According to who, I wonder. But anyway, and Apple pays and pays Apple nothing for the services that have helped make them one of the most recognizable brands in the world. A large part of their success is due to the App Store, along with all the tools and technology that Spotify uses to build, update, and share with their app with Apple users around the world. See, this is where I think Marco and I jump in and say, this is it. This is Apple saying,
right, but they say
we did
a large part of their success is due to the App Store. They don't say all of their success, 100% of their success. They say a large part. They don't even do a percent.
I don't think a lot of people are discovering Spotify through the App Store. I'm pretty sure people know about Spotify who want to search for it, and they just need to download the Spotify app.
I'm just saying what Apple says. Apple is not, really Apple is not saying that they're bringing no value to the platform, that Spotify brings no value to the iOS platform.
They're towing the line. They're coming right up the line and saying,
I'm just saying, like, I know it makes you feel that way, and the emotional impact of it, but they literally aren't saying that. And as for the market share, this is a great one, because I believe that Spotify has a free tier.
Yes.
That's got to massively impact their market share. How many people pay for Spotify versus how many people pay for Apple Music? What does that share break down to? Because, you know, Spotify doesn't make money from free customers. Like, it wants to convert them into paying customers, but, like, it has to pay money for the music that the free customers stream, right? And so it's like they are negative, right? And so, yeah, Spotify, that has a free tier, has 56% market share. That is actually damning for Apple, that said, look, your competitor has a free option and they're barely ahead of you. Or I don't know what Apple's share is. Maybe it's not the other, you know, remaining 44% or whatever. But like,
there's other players, but Apple's a pretty big one.
But yeah, like I would, citing this market share, and by the way, market share is not the be all end all, but citing this market share when Spotify has a free tier is really not particularly convincing.
Yep, couldn't agree more. Continuing, we are proud to play a key role supporting Spotify's success, as we have for developers of all sizes from the App Store's earliest days. The European Commission is issuing this decision just before their new regulation, the Digital Markets Act, comes into force. Apple is set to comply with the DMA in days, and our plans include changes to the rules challenged here. What's clear is that this decision is not grounded in existing competition law. It's an effort by the commission to enforce the DMA before the DMA becomes law.
Look, you already scolded us for this, and we're changing it, and we're totally compliant, aren't we? Right? I don't know what you're doing this fine for, and it's like, Apple, you got in trouble for this before the DMA. Like, you have to sort of, like, I know things take a long time and they overlap with each other, but like, it's a timeline of events. It's like, you did this bad thing and then we passed the DMA and now you have to comply with that, but just because, like, you already passed the law that's making me fix this, you still get punished for doing it. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with, like, you can say the EU shouldn't, it's like, if you want to sell things in the EU, you got to deal with the EU and their rules, and this is how their system works, and you don't get to erase your past fine because now you're doing something that makes the bad thing you did impossible anyway, as far as you're concerned, again, assuming you comply. So, not a strong response, but I think it could have been worse, and I do think that Apple is trying to thread the needle. They even had a thing. The one thing I think you can really call them on, it's not quoted here, so I'll try to do it from memory, but at one point they said, you know, App Store is great. It's a level playing field for everybody. Like, this is not the exact
today,
language,
developers but... compete on a level playing field on the App Store. Apps are reviewed according to a comprehensive set of rules, which are designed to protect our users. And meeting those rules means developers of all sizes can reach more than a billion devices around the world.
All right. So that's their level playing field argument. And they've said that before or whatever. And then in the same document, I believe they say, hey, we flew Apple engineers out to Spotify to help them with their app.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a level playing field. How many Apple engineers has Apple flown out to you, Casey, to help you with your I'm not saying this is wrong. I'm saying it makes perfect sense, but like Apple can't do both arguments in the same document and say it's a totally level playing field. Everybody gets the same shot, but we flew engineers to Spotify.
Also,
don't say it's a level playing field. It's not.
And yep, also, why might it have been valuable to fly engineers?
Right.
To
yeah.
Spotify?
Why does Spotify get different treatment?
I mean, maybe it's because an iPhone that didn't have a Spotify app would be less valuable to iPhone customers.
Yep.
Yeah. What I mean, and again, I've said since the first time we discussed this years and years ago, Apple should do that. I don't
agreed.
Think this,
yeah,
this
yeah,
whole,
yeah.
like, it's 100% they should. The big customers and the good customers should. That's one of my complaints about the App Store, that being a quote-unquote good developer that makes quality apps doesn't get you enough privileges in Apple's
yep.
book, right?
agreed.
So, but all I'm saying is that in the same document, they also want to say it's a level playing field, and it's obviously not, nor should it be in this way. Obviously, the EU wants to make there be more competition, and the main playing field they're trying to level is not between different companies in the App Store. It is always between all the EU stuff is between all the companies in the App Store and the person who owns the App Store, the company that owns the App Store. It's always between Apple and N developers. It's not between like Spotify and Tidal, right? The EU is not trying to level the playing field between Spotify and Tidal because they think Spotify is getting unfair preferential treatment from Apple. That could be a thing that they could complain about, but that's not what they're complaining. They're complaining that Apple, who owns the platform and doesn't pay itself 30%, has a huge advantage over Spotify.
We've even flown our engineers to Stockholm to help Spotify's teams in person, and the result is that when a user opens the Spotify app, listens to music on their commute, or asks Siri to play a song from their library, everything just works. And again, Spotify pays Apple nothing.
Those engineers that they fly out there, uh-huh. they should have them work on Apple Music, because sometimes it doesn't just work there.
For real. Also, earlier, or just a bit earlier in the same document, our app review team has reviewed and approved 421 versions of the Spotify app, usually with same day turnaround, and frequently expedites reviews at Spotify's request. But yes,
must
all of
nice.
Us are equal. Yeah, must be friggin' nice.
Well, in all fairness, app review has been a lot faster recently.
It has been. You're right. You're right.
It is, but yeah, they're getting nice treatment. And again, I think they should. But like, that's it's just weird for them to say in the same document, level playing field. Are all developers treated the same?
Well, and the thing is, and I think Apple actually, they do make some good points in this document, which is why, like, I see what they were going for. They do have some good points. One of the best points they make is that Spotify, for some reason, does not use the reader app exception.
That is true.
And it is kind of like, and I can think maybe why, maybe they're all right,
hold on.
Some
we
kind of
should
strategy,
we should explain.
But,
we should explain real quick what it yeah. is. So reader apps, which is a very poor name, but it's the name that Apple landed on, are apps like ebook apps, Netflix, things where basically you're getting new content regularly. And certain apps fall into this category, like, you know, Netflix and Spotify, where they can apply for and get an exception to this anti-steering thing. And that only has happened in the last few years, I think. I don't remember exactly when it was.
A year and a half ago or so. And it's specifically, it isn't just apps that have new content. It's apps where, like, the primary purpose of the app is to access media that you are consuming, that you have purchased on their website or have a streaming subscription or something. And so, like, you know, yeah, Netflix, the Kindle, like stuff like that, it's like that is the main purpose of the app, is to consume certain, you know, predefined types of content, audio, video, books, you know, stuff like that, and that's it. And this allows them to link out to their website by putting up a scare sheet that using Apple SDK, saying you're about to leave this app and Apple can't protect you from the scary
Your
scammy
stuff's
website.
Gonna get stolen. Ah!
Yep. But you can get an exception. You can have a single fixed link that your app can link out to with certain design requirements around what the link has to look like. That basically says you can create an account on Netflix.com, and then Netflix.com can be an underlined blue label that you can click on, and it will show the scare sheet, and then kick you out to Netflix in the web browser. And they are allowed to then have you purchase things there without paying Apple any commission, with no, that's it, Apple's out of the game, no requirements after that. So it is like the one major exception to the App Store, like, you know, no external payment kind of integration at all. It's the one big exception. Apple made this exception whenever it was a year and a half ago, whenever that was, for this one category of apps, the reader, quote, category, and Spotify qualifies. And for some reason, they don't do it. And
I think I can understand why they don't, because it's so limiting. Like, they want more, essentially. Like, you know, they want freedom to basically be able to have a big flashing banner that says, save 30%, lower price, dollar sign this. Like, all the rules that Apple has about that link are so incredibly restrictive, right?
That's
Spotify,
true.
I think, strategically decided that, like, look, let's continue to lobby the EU regulation body to say, we're a European company, we're getting screwed by Apple, we want you to fix things. And it makes their case stronger to say, look at the state of our app. We don't even have a way to let people go over there. Like, maybe if they had done this, then Apple would say, look, they're already linking to us. There's no problem to be solved. And I don't know if it makes their case stronger or weaker, but either way, I don't think Spotify is satisfied with the reader exception. And so their argument now has clarity of saying, look, here's the app. We can't link out to our things. We should be able to. We should be able to without draconian restrictions about it.
Yeah, and because the main restrictions on it are, first of all, the link you link out to has to be like a statically defined URL. So you cannot have like a user ID appended to the end of it or something. And so to use it to actually like bump someone out of the app, buy something on your website, and then get kicked back into your app can be very cumbersome for the user and would have a low conversion rate as a result. So, and Apple knows that. That's one of the reasons why they require it to be a fixed URL with no parameters. So that's one reason. But also, as John was just saying, like you can't, they have actually rules against, like, you can't say around the link in your UI, this is cheaper on our website, go get it here for only $10 instead of $13.
Yeah, let alone by how much cheaper it is. Yeah. Like, you can't do, like, basic marketing of, like, this, you will save this amount of money by clicking here.
Yeah, you can't even say you will save money by clicking here. Like, you can say nothing about it. You can simply say in neutral language, like, you can create an account on our website here. And so there's a lot of restrictions around
that. You can create an account on our website, you can attend a lab, but don't say anything else.
That's right. And then also, if you use the external payment reader app exemption in an app, that app is not allowed to also use in-app purchase. So Apple's saying, fine, you know what? You're going to have competition with our system? You don't get our system at all. And so for some apps, they would rather offer both, because then they can get the higher conversion rates of people who will only use in-app purchase. Then they get them as well. But Apple says, nope, if you apply for this exemption, you are not allowed to use our system at all. We're going to take our ball and go home. Which, honestly, I think that's their prerogative to do.
But at that point, it's not fair, because so we can make our own system that looks as nice as and works as well as in-app purchase? Like, no, you're literally not allowed to. Not that you're not technically capable of it.
Right.
You're literally not allowed to make something that's as nice as in-app purchase. In-app purchase can show you the prices. It can send information and loop you back through. Like, you don't lose any. Like, it's just, they are disallowed, they're by rules not allowed to make something that actually is competitive with an app purchase, and that's ridiculous.
Yeah, but that being said, like, I think the reader app exemption is by far the biggest hole Apple has opened up in their tight grip on IAP, and Spotify qualifies to use it and they don't use it. And I think that I see why they want to do that, what you were just saying. Like, strategically, they want to be able to go to regulators and say, we're not going to do this, you know, highly restrictive, half-baked solution, because this is not what we want. But I think it leaves Apple a huge counterargument to then say, look, we gave them this door and they're willingly not taking it.
I'm not sure that's much of a counterargument, though, given who they're arguing to, which is the European Fair. Commission, and Spotify is a European company. And, like, it's, again, when you're not in some, when there's not like legal precedent or whatever, because these are government bodies. Like, it's the difference when we talk about these things in the U.S. and we'll talk about Epic in a second. But like, when there's court cases and there's law and there's precedent and there's rules of evidence, it's different than, like, a lot of those court cases. What they say is like, look, if you don't like the decision, then, you know, Congress should pass a law that changes this, right? And in the EU, it's not a court case where they're trying to interpret current law and say whether you're violated. The EU is basically just saying, like, look, we're making a bunch of rules. Right. The DMA is a bunch of new rules. That is the equivalent of, like, here are some new rules that you have to follow if you want to be here. In the U.S., we just accept the fact that Congress can't actually pass any laws. But in the EU, they can make up new regulations, apparently with reasonable efficiency. Are those regulations good or well-written? No, but they make them. And so it's not like, oh, they have a strong argument here, because the EU will say, yeah, no, we decided we don't buy that. That's why we made these new rules. So do it.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't want to get too much into it, but I get the argument that Apple makes that, look, they put in a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of effort making this platform that we are all, as developers and as users, eager to use. And they deserve to be compensated in some way, shape, or form for that effort.
And they
so
are.
So far, I think I'm with them. But it's what Marco said, right? First of all, they're pretty handsomely compensated. And second of all, I don't feel like I am getting 30% of value from what they give me. And that's, I think, the disconnect is if they were doing a whole bunch more and maybe, you know, sometime we can argue about what that would look like. But if they were doing a whole bunch more for me, maybe I wouldn't grumble so much about 15 to 30%. But I feel like I'm getting very little from the App Store, and I feel like I'm getting poked in the eye from Apple on a regular basis with regard to all these policies. Well, maybe not me. I shouldn't say that. I'm not personally getting poked in the eye, but I'm seeing all of these other developers getting poked in the eye. And it kind of makes you wonder, all right, when is it my turn? And it's tough because it's hard for me trying to take myself out of this situation as much as possible and trying to be a neutral third party. I get Apple's point. Like, they made the platform. They want to be compensated for it. I get that. But I think that they've really lost sight of, and we said this a while ago, they've lost sight of the fact that that platform would be a piece of shit if it wasn't for all of these third-party apps, right? And I don't think they've really embraced or understood this. And I don't know that they ever will, short of all of us, you know, unifying and deciding to pull our apps from the App Store for a few days, which will never freaking work anyway. But I just don't think they'll ever get it. And it's that, like entitled attitude that it just makes my skin crawl. And that's what I find so upsetting. And so when something like this happens, I'm like, yeah, all right, cool. I'm here for it.
Yeah. And again, like, and it hurts them in so many other areas. Like, again, look at Vision Pro. Here's a brand new platform, desperately needs software, and no one's there for it.
I don't know if we want to over-index on that. I know we said that, and it's a narrative that makes sense, but, like, also they haven't sold a lot of them and it's expensive, and I think a lot of the people who I think it's part of the reason developers sat out as sort of a protest, but honestly they're gonna make apps for it if the platform is successful. Like, that's in the end, that is how these things usually work. Like, maybe they'll make them grudgingly and maybe they won't be great and it won't be as popular as the iPhone platform or whatever, but I suspect that if they sell many millions more Vision Pros, all those companies that sat out will suddenly be like, oh, I guess we have to make an app for this thing too. But to your point, it's not going to be the vibrant developer ecosystem where everyone is anxious to hop on board like the iPhone was in the early days.
Yeah, and I don't know. It just continues kind of the sour attitude that Apple keeps creating among developers and you know, small and large. You know, obviously the large companies are not huge fans of Apple right now and have not been for a while because of all this stuff. And you know, they've also now they keep souring the small developers with their attitude too. And I think it's going to be, I think it's gonna be difficult for them to keep drumming up developer interest in ways that will benefit their platforms tremendously. And it is, I think, a long-term strategic error, as I've said before, that they don't loosen up any further. And it causes all these problems that will potentially affect their platforms in much larger ways. You know, whatever dinky, piddly profit they're making on the difference between what they make now from the App Store and what they would make if they loosened their grip a little bit, that's nothing compared to what they make from a new platform's hardware sales, like the iPhone, you know, like the Apple Watch, like the iPad, like they have these platforms that need good app ecosystems. They need people to want to develop apps for them. They need new apps that are coming on the market to be developed for them first or only. And right now, the customer volume on mostly the iPhone is really the main driving factor there. They're really losing a lot of the developer goodwill. They've burned it all over the course of the last 15 years or so. Like, they've lost so much of it. Developers used to be willing to make a lot of apps for platforms that didn't have massive numbers of users, like, historically, almost everything Apple's ever made. And now that attitude has been severely eroded by the Tim Cook era of, like, squeezing every single penny out of developers. And then as you start seeing, you know, some of the hardware products mature and the growth slow down, you start scrounging around the couch cushions. Hey, where can we squeeze next? And you start doing really ridiculous things like some of the internet purchase rules and, you know, starting to eye companies and saying, hey, you're making money. How can we get a piece of that? And I mean, it does make the money in the short term, but I think that is very much bean counter thinking and missing the big picture of what is this doing to the long term health of our platforms, and specifically our hardware platforms, where we make way more money than this little piddly, you know, app store tax.
Yeah.
Let's hear from one small developer who's happy about Apple. Oh, but only because of the rules that they just had to comply with.
Exactly. So Riley Testet, who runs Alt Store, which is a kind of side-loading marketplace sort of thing that
was using some, like, was using like enterprise certificates or some other technical like test.
I don't recall
stuff.
Exactly how it works. I thought you had
did
to do something
in,
with the developer
the, jailbreak
account.
Era. Was that like that? Yeah. What kind of where that came from?
It's what it sounds like. Alternative Store was a place where you could go to install apps onto your phone that's not the App Store. And you're like, wait a second, I thought that was impossible. Well, they were using every possible trick in the book to try to use Apple's supported schemes like enterprise certificates or Tesla. I don't actually know what they use, but like it was never a mainstream thing because it was always on the fringes of allowability. So as you can imagine with the Digital Marketplace Act and Apple's in theory compliance with it, now Apple supports third-party marketplaces, and you would imagine that Alt Store would be first in line. And setting aside how the hell they got a 1 million euro...
No, they don't have to. Did you not letter. See that? They oh, Apple has changed they're... the rules.
Oh, no, I didn't see that. Please tell me then.
Oh, I don't remember specifically where I saw this, so I don't know if I'll be able
like
to provide a link in the show notes.
I think it came out.
It was in the last 24 to 48
too
hours.
Too much news, man.
There really
is.
A big
week.
Suffice to say, it might have even been on Apple's developer site. Again, I don't know if I'll be able to put my finger on a
this,
link
this
for you.
This should have been
but...
follow-up. I'm sorry. If I had seen this, I would have put it there.
No, I'm sorry. I should have as well. That's on me. But nevertheless, they made a few small tweaks to their rules and procedures and policies with regard to the DMA stuff. And one of them was, and I can't remember the specifics, but basically you don't always or perhaps don't ever need a line of credit or whatever that term is, or I forget if it was in certain circumstances. But basically they said it isn't always required. As
I mean, it wasn't always before
said.
Because I think if you're like a nonprofit or a charity, there was an exception, but Alt Store is not a charity and I don't think it's a nonprofit.
Oh, here we go. Alternative app marketplace requirements. I will put a link in the show notes to make it easier for developers who want to create an alternative app. Let me try that all over again.
Yep.
Okay, here we go. So I'll put a link in the show notes. Alternative app marketplace requirements. To make it easier for developers who want to create alternative app marketplaces, we've added a new eligibility criteria that lets developers qualify without a standby letter of credit. For details, view the marketplace support page, which honestly I never got around to doing. But that is a thing, and we will put a link in the show notes.
So anyway, the story is Alt Store got its Marketplace Kit entitlement, which in developer speak means they got the thing from Apple that says you are now allowed to use the framework that you have to use to make a third-party marketplace. So Alt Store is going to make a third-party marketplace. If you're wondering whoever under these rules is actually going to make a third-party marketplace, now that they don't have to have a million euros in the bank, the answer is, for one, Alt Store. So I guess good for them, assuming that what Apple has done is compliant with the DMA, which we still don't know the answer to. But hey, everyone's making app stores, and you know who else is excited to make an alternate marketplace?
Hold on, before you get there, real-time follow-up. So from the from a different page linked from that newsroom post or that developer newsroom post, blah, 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 blah. You can do either of the following. Number one, provide Apple with a standby letter of credit in the amount of 1 million euros from a financial institution that's at least A-rated or equivalent by S&P, Fitch, or Moody's, and maintain that standby letter of credit as long as your alternative app marketplace is in operation, or, and I think this is the new thing, be a member of good standing in the Apple Developer Program for 2 continuous years or more, and have an app that had more than 1 million first annual installs on iOS in the EU in the prior calendar year.
What a weird set of requirements.
I mean, yeah, I guess so.
That is so weird.
So I guess if your junk is popular and you're going to owe us the whatever it is, the fee, the core technology fee.
There was also, like I said, the charity and nonprofit exceptions in there. But I guess that doesn't apply to Alt Store.
I don't think so, but who knows? Anyway, that's apparently the breaking news.
So one of the bits of news that we didn't get to many weeks ago was that Epic, the game company that's been in big fights with Apple, had said, we're totally going to have our own alternative marketplace for iOS in the EU. And you'd be like, Epic, how can you do that? You don't even have a developer account. It's like, no, we got one. We made a new developer account in like Sweden or something, and Apple gave it to us. And that was a story several weeks back we didn't get to because we have too much content. But basically, Epic got a Apple developer account for like some other subsidiary name thing or whatever. Like, it's not their old account back. It's like a new account. And then Epic's like, we're going to use this one to make a third-party store. And they were super excited about it until like yesterday. Or today, I guess.
No, it was a couple hours changed. Ago. Yeah, so on The Verge, Epic says that its iOS game store plans are stalled because why? Because Apple has banned its developer account. So, oopsie-doopsies.
No, not that one. The new one.
Yeah, exactly. The new one.
Oh, my God.
So from The Verge, Epic's plans to release its own third-party app store on iOS in the EU could be in trouble. Could be in trouble after Apple terminated the developer account it planned to use. In a blog post published today, the company shared a letter sent by Apple's lawyers, which called Epic, quote, verifiably untrustworthy, quote. I looked through this. I didn't notice where that was said. Maybe I missed it.
I've got some snippets coming up.
All right. So The Verge continues and said Apple does not believe that Epic will comply with its contractual commitments under its developer agreement.
Yeah. So let me just say this. So Epic, we only have Epic's side of this, which is always suspect because, you know, there's a lot of bad blood there or whatever. But Epic posted a bunch of images of text because they're dumb, of email exchanges, like the emails between them and Apple. I'm sure this is not an exhaustive list of emails, so it's not every back and forth. It's the back and forth Epic wanted us to see. But just in those back and forth, there's lots of juicy stuff. I don't know, like, Apple did approve this account. Like, they had to go through talks with Apple and say, hey, you know, we know we're Epic and we would like to make a new account because we're going to make a third-party store. Is that cool? Like, we didn't see that exchange, but that obviously happened. Well, Apple didn't accidentally...
I don't know that it did, because why? It's all automated. Like, if I wanted to create a new store
I'm pretty sure Epic even said, hey, we work with Apple to get our developer account.
Oh,
Apple
all right. Was
like,
well,
it's not like
that.
Apple just noticed it had appeared. Apple allowed this account to exist. And then I think through some ill-advised exchanges, like Epic was complaining to Apple that they didn't get access to something and they thought it should be treated well. Like, they
had the emails. Like, The Verge posted the emails between Epic's people and Phil Schiller.
Right, no, we're about to quote those, right? But again, we don't know if it's all the emails. But what I'm saying is, how did Epic begin conversing in an adversarial way that eventually led to, and we're going to get to exactly how because it's funny, led to their banning? Because it's kind of like, you had the account. If you had just kept your mouth shut and not antagonized Apple and gotten into a fight, maybe you'd still have your developer account, because the reason their account was rejected, again, it's not because Apple didn't know they created one and was surprised to see it and said, oh, we totally need to ban that. Apple allowed it to be created, knew it had been created, but then essentially, I think Epic basically like made a poor choice to get in a fight with Apple. And so let's just go through the broad strokes of that fight. You can see the emails, we'll link to them. You can look at the stupid images or whatever. But here's what it boils down to. You should read Phil Schiller basically explaining why Apple has decided to ban this account after allowing it to be created.
In the past, Epic has entered into agreements with Apple and then broken them. For example, you testified that Epic Games Inc. entered into the developer program with full understanding of its terms and then chose to intentionally breach the agreement with Apple.
And by the way, you as this is Epic. He's talking to Tim Sweeney and Epic.
You also testified that Epic deliberately violated Apple's rules to make a point and for financial gain. More recently, you have described our DMA compliance plan as, quote, hot garbage, quote, a quote, horror show, quote, and a, quote, devious new instance of malicious compliance, quote. And you have complained about what you called, quote, junk fees, quote, and, quote, Apple taxes, quote. Your colorful criticism of our DMA compliance plan, coupled with Epic's past practice of intentionally violating contractual provisions with which it disagrees, strongly suggests that Epic Sweden does not intend to follow the rules. Another intentional breach could threaten the integrity of the iOS platform as well as the security and privacy of users. You have stated that allowing enrollment of Epic Games Sweden in the developer program is quote, a good faith move by Apple, quote. We invite you to provide us with written assurance that you are also acting in good faith and that Epic Games Sweden will, despite your public actions and rhetoric, honor all of its commitments. In plain and qualified terms, please tell us why we should trust Epic this time.
So this is Phil Schiller, a named person, in an actual email to Epic saying, hey, you burned us before. Remember that time where you intentionally broke the rules and we had a lawsuit and we won and we kicked you out of the store? Do you remember that? And now we let you have this, you know, Epic Games Sweden thing, and you're telling us you want an alternative app store? Why, you know, tell us why, tell us you're going to be good. Like, you know, was it, you know, provide us with written assurance that you are acting in good faith. Tell us that you're going to follow the rules, right? So here's Tim Sweeney, CEO of Epic. Here's Tim Sweeney's reply.
So Tim writes, thanks for reaching out. Epic and its subsidiaries, such corporate speak, I love it. Epic and its subsidiaries are acting in good faith and will comply with all terms of current and future agreements with Apple, and will be glad to provide Apple with any specific further assurances on the topic that you'd like.
That's the entire email, by the way. That's the, except for his signature. That's it. Yeah. So Phil Schiller says, Epic, you've been bad. Are you going to be good? Tell us in writing you're going to be good. Tim Sweeney says, in a very short paragraph, we are totally going to be good. We will comply with all your terms, current and future. If there's anything specific you want us, any specific assurances, if you want us to say specifically we won't, like, TP your house, like, we'll say it. Just let us know. So I saw this exchange, and I'm like, all right, well, so Phil Schiller is basically saying, look, we don't like you. You're bad. You're saying mean things about us. Seems like you're going to break the rules. Tell us you're not going to break them. Tim Sweeney says, we're totally not going to break the rules. Here's so Apple's response.
Mr. Sweeney's response to that request was wholly insufficient and not credible. He's the CEO. How is that not credible? Anyway, it boiled down to an unsupported, trust us.
I mean, well, tell us, pause here. What did he want? What could be in that document in text, in written form, that would not be trust? Is there some kind of like blockchain derived, like trusted intermediate, like...
I asked
for written assurances. You got written assurances, and it's like, they were wholly insufficient. Like, was there not enough groveling? Did he not apologize for the hot garbage comment?
I mean, I have to assume there's a lot more going on here that was not.
Yeah, like, is this not all the emails? Maybe.
Yeah, and not all of the you know stuff behind the scenes. Like, there has to be more to this than this. I mean, because first of all, I mean, look, this. This is really stupid that this even happened.
It's like a flame war on Usenet. It totally is.
It is. And I understand if Apple really wants to still stick their finger in Epic's eye, but then why let them create the second account in the first place?
It's almost like they changed their mind. Anyway, finish reading Apple's response here, the part that we've excerpted from it.
All right. So again, Apple's response. Mr. Sweeney's response to that request was wholly insufficient and not credible. It boiled down to an unsupported trust us. History shows, however, that Epic is verifiably untrustworthy, hence the request for meaningful commitments. And the minimal assurances in Mr. Sweeney's curt response were swiftly undercut by a litany of public attacks on Apple's policies, compliance plan, and business model. They provide an example tweet.
Well, okay, so now I think we have to, since we've made this running joke for like years and years now, we have to now say this is a legit example where running to the press did not help.
That's true.
Because they're like, you're still being mean to us in tweets, right? Oh, basically, they're saying you are verifiably untrustworthy. So, like, why ask for assurances from somebody who, no matter what you say, you're not going to trust them? And right. then they're saying, and also, you keep being mean to us.
And why, again, like, what, whenever they gave them that new account, like 2 weeks ago, whenever that was, like, what changed between the lawsuit few years ago and that?
Yeah, they
then
thought
changed
like
back.
They're not gonna they're I think Apple thought they were like the reason I refer this to like a flame war, like an argument online, is like this is no longer company versus company. It's so nakedly person versus person. Like, I don't like you and I don't like your face and you're not being sufficiently deferential and I don't trust you and I asked for assurances but you weren't nice enough and you're making mean tweets about us, so yeah. And again, I'm not saying whether this is right or wrong, legally illegal or whatever. I'm just characterizing what we're seeing here. And in the end, a lot of these corporate things do boil down to that, because corporations are run by individuals and individuals have feelings and emotions and do stuff like this. But you almost never, especially when it comes to Apple, get to see this personal, you know, indignity and this final one by this Apple, we say Apple response. I think they went through their law firm to do it or whatever,
yeah,
but it still reads like it's Phil Schiller saying it personally.
Yeah. So continuing, Moreover, a recent submission in the Australian litigation suggests that Epic Games Sweden AB is part of a global effort to undermine or evade Apple's rules. It's a grand, insidious conspiracy. Apple is rightly concerned that Epic Games Sweden AB does not intend to adhere to its contractual commitments to Apple and is, in fact, a vehicle to manipulate proceedings in other jurisdictions.
And by the way, Epic Games Sweden AB is that's the account that they got like to make their app store.
Given the past and current conduct of Epic, Apple cannot allow Epic Games Sweden AB to be part of its ecosystem. Please be advised that Apple has effective immediately terminated the developer program membership of Epic Games Sweden AB. As you know, in addition to the concerns we have outlined above, the U.S. judgment expressly provides that, quote, Apple has the contractual right to terminate its DPLA with any or all. And then I lost the rest of the court here. Sorry.
But what they're basically saying is, hey, remember that court case we won against in the U.S.? Part of the judgment was we can totally deny you for any reason.
And guess what? We're gonna deny you, and we don't need to tell you why.
But they did. They said you're mean to us, and we don't like you, and we don't trust you. And even though you said you're gonna follow the rules, we don't think you are. In fact, we think this company is part of this wider effort to undermine us in other jurisdictions. And you know, Epic won a court case against Apple in the U.S., not in the EU. And the Epic versus what the EU is going to say about Apple versus Epic, if anything, will be interesting to see. But this is just like, I'm going to say it's unseemly for all parties. But Epic, like, I feel like Tim Sweeney has always just been out there as a personality, and he is who he is. And especially in the gaming world, this is unfortunately not as uncommon as you might think, where there are big personalities trash talking each other in the press or whatever. But that's not how Apple usually works. And this is not like discovery in a court case, because we saw so many good things in the Epic trial, for example. This is Apple emailing with a big company, and the big company doing one of the rudest things you can do as an individual is like, I'm just going to post all our private emails that we've back and forth to, because they
that
show
is,
you to be a jerk.
That is gross.
Right. Yep. And that's right up their alley. Right. And by the way, did Epic show all of the emails? Is Epic, we'll see. That's Apple's MO is usually not to say, hey, you didn't post all the emails, but it's more like to, give responses through their lawyers. This is mostly, I know this just seems like it's a silly thing, and it is. I just thought it was super entertaining. I don't think there's any big news here other than Apple's DMA compliance and third-party marketplaces. That whole thing, even if it is compliant, it's not going great for anybody. I mean, Alt Store got their marketplace kit thing, but they are a small player in the grand scheme of things. Epic, it seemed like Apple and Epic were patching things up, but somehow Epic got re-entangled and pissed off Apple again and got booted out again, and it's just, where are all these third-party marketplaces giving increased competition to the people in the EU? We talked about it when we talked about the DMA compliance. Is DMA actually achieving the ends that the EU wants it to achieve? I'm going to say the answer remains no. It's not. It's not working well. It's because Apple's compliance with the DMA is incredibly restrictive, because Apple is still wielding sort of, personally vindictive power against the people it doesn't want to have stores, and the number of people who would even, like, Epic is one of the few people who would want to have a store because they'd want to have it out of spite, essentially. Like, even if it costs them money, they just want to have it and be in there. And everyone else is like, these terms don't look great. So things are not going well. I don't know if they're not going well for the EU, they're not going well for Apple. I say both. They're not going well for either party in this whole thing. And Apple, we didn't even have time to put this in the notes, but Apple just released iOS 17.4, which has all their supposed DMA compliance and all the scare screens and all the pick your default browser and all that stuff. And people who are looking at that are saying the choice is good, and making Apple comply and giving people browser choice is good or whatever, but the user experience is worsened because of the kind of passive aggressive way that Apple has implemented all of this. So, and here we are over in the US where we don't get any of this, which is both a blessing and a curse, but we do get to watch it play out.
Yeah. And I think part of the problem is that the EU regulations seem to be written, this is all maybe above our heads, but it seems from the outside that they are written with a certain degree of optimism about how they will be followed. And over again, we see Apple dodge and weave and find new ways to be prickly and stingy. And it seems like no matter what regulation has in mind for how things, quote, should be in the regulator's mind, Apple finds ways around it very easily. and very deftly. And then the whole thing is kind of a joke and doesn't really achieve what they wanted to achieve. And I don't know, like, why anyone thinks it's going to be different, you know, with different, different.
Well,
attempts
if they say Apple's DMA compliance is in fact not compliant, then Apple would have to go back and change things to make it more compliant. And I don't know how long that can go back and forth, but I think the teeth that the EU put on the DMA are bigger than the "we'll just fine you." It's like some percentage or something. It's some number that would be monstrous for Apple. So somehow Apple and the EU are going to have to work this out. At this point, I really hope the EU doesn't say, "we looked at Apple's response and we have determined that it is compliant," because that's basically them admitting we screwed up when we wrote our regulation. Right? Because if this is compliant, you screwed up, right? If they say it isn't compliant, then how does that resolve itself? What do you want Apple to change? How do they have to, and they do that back and forth. And it's not, this is not great. Like, this is one of the benefits of the system that people in America are more used to is like, oh, it's competition between companies and they all work in their best interest and the marketplace sorts it out, right? But all these things that we're talking about here is like, well, when that stops working, when there's too little competition, how do you solve that? It's like, well, that's when the government has to step in. That's why we have antitrust laws. And doing that, essentially taking a competitive marketplace that has become insufficiently competitive, in your opinion, and putting the competition back in, not by adding new competitors, but by essentially making the players who are dominating it now saying there's certain things that they can't do, it's really hard because it's like the government saying, be less successful, companies, and that's not a thing that companies like, and that's also kind of a form of impairing competition. So trying to restore competition through regulation is actually really, really hard. It's an important thing, and it's the role of government to do that. They shouldn't shirk that because it's hard, but I do want to acknowledge that it is hard because a lot of things that you can do either don't work or make things worse.
Yeah, it's a mess. Who would have thought that this is more interesting and juicier drama than the current season of Love is Blind? I did not see that one coming, I got to tell you. Yeah, so we'll see how this plays out. I don't know. It's a lot. It's a lot. And
it seems like every day there's more news on this. So by next week, who knows what will have happened?
Yeah, so true. Yikes. All right.
Programming note. I think we should do Ask ATP now and do the European crash test thing for the after show.
Oh, yeah. No, right. Forget about European crash test. No way we're doing that. We did three topics. We did it.
Yeah,
it's kind of a good after show because it's a neutral topic, really.
Yeah, I don't even think we do Ask ATP, to be honest.
Just leave that in the notes. That'll be next week we'll get to it, if then.
I personally don't think we have time for Ask ATP, which I'm not grumpy about. I think that's fine, but or we do it as the after show this week, one or the other.
But what do we have for an after show in terms of
nothing important? I had some minor that we can talk about, but
the first Ask ATP question I think is actually kind of relevant to the topics this week, so I think we should probably cover that.
Do you want to do that one Ask ATP as an after show?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, we can do that. All right, cool. All right, 1 second. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Squarespace and Trade. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. And we will talk to you next week.
So we didn't have time for Ask ATP this week, but we have one relevant Ask ATP topic that we thought maybe we could bump into the after show. Mark Robinson writes, if you were Apple CEO for a day and only had enough time to resolve just one of Apple's many legal problems, which problem would you resolve and how? It's a very good question. John, can we get all your whining and moaning about the parameters of the question out of the way real quick so we can then answer it?
Yeah, my main one is, what defines a single legal problem?
Of course.
Does that mean take the EU, for example, the anti-steering thing, is that one legal problem? Or can you combine that with the DMA? Or are those two separate legal problems?
Yeah,
and you
is
have
it
to pick
one
which one you
case?
Want to resolve? Anyway. Difficult. I know what they're getting at, though. I understand the spirit of the question if the letter of it is very difficult to define.
You know,
also,
I'm going to
breathe right over the fact that it's pretty much impossible to solve anything
in one day.
No, yes, but I think it's like a magic wand. Like you have a magic wand that can do it,
yeah,
right?
Solve one legal problem-ish somehow.
Yeah, we're not saying how to solve it. I'm going to say it's the magic wand thing, because otherwise it's like, well, how do you solve it? If there was an easy solution, Apple would have done it by now. Or, well, not really. Anyway, Magic Wand is in play.
Right, Magic Wand is in play. So I'm going to pull a top four and deviate from the purpose of the question and answer a slightly different question entirely. If I were Apple CEO for a day and I only had enough time to resolve one problem that maybe is legal but maybe isn't, I would get the heck out of China, like as best as I can. And I think that includes, you know, having handed over iCloud.
Is that a legal problem?
I'm taking a turn.
You're bad at influence, Marco.
Yeah, I know. It's true. It's the devil on my shoulder. No, I think I would. It makes me feel really gross what they've done with, you know, handing over or having all their software running on China controlled servers for iCloud. Or I forget the details. I might have that slightly wrong, but you get the point I'm driving at. I don't love that. I don't love that all the manufacturing is there. I get why. I get why they did the iCloud thing. I get why the manufacturing is there. But I would divest from China using my magic wand. I would divest from China as quickly and as effectively as I possibly could, because to me, I think that is the number one thing that should keep Apple up at night. And I don't know that it is. It might be. But that's the thing that scares me the most. And that's what I would do, which I know is not.
In two ways. So I think that in one way, that's a good use of a magic wand, because that is like incredibly hard to do. I believe Apple is doing it, but it's going to take like just so many years and so difficult to do. But on the other hand, it is the worst thing to use a magic wand on, because if you did have that magic wand and you used it, that would invoke maximum retaliation from China. Essentially, Apple would be out of China, which is a huge market, which part of the reason Apple is doing things the way they are and slowly kind of trying to disentangle from China real slow, but real slow, is because they want to continue to sell products to the billions of people in China.
Oh, yeah. No,
and
I get
if you were to magic wand your way out of China, China would be like, sorry, you're gone. Kind of like Facebook, right? It's like, no more China for you. I hope you're happy with what you've done by magic wanding a gigantic supply chain into existence and presumably magic wanding millions of people to work that supply chain. This is definitely not a legal problem that you can solve. And it's really stretching the magic wand, because replacing China manufacturing is such a gargantuan problem that it's like multi-decade thing that only Apple could possibly even have a chance of doing. And I still don't know if they're going to be successful, but I like your chutzpah, even though you can't read the question, it didn't solve a legal problem.
Right. All right. So Marco, since I'm hoping that you will also take a left turn or perhaps a right turn to my left turn, what is your answer?
I'm going to continue on the theme of the episode a little bit, and I want to my modification would be, or my action would be, to try to diffuse the tension around App Store payments in a way that is most likely to actually be somewhat palatable to Apple and least likely to disrupt their precious services revenue, while also providing the maximum amount of like relief on the pressure and around this. And so my proposal here is, remember that reader rule we were talking about earlier, the reader exception, where, quote, reader apps that have, like, you know, AV services or books or whatever can link out to external payments after showing a scare sheet with a whole bunch of, you know, qualifications and restrictions on what the URL can be and how it's displayed. But once you're linked out to Safari for the payments, you owe Apple no commissions. You have to track nothing. You have to have them audit your books. Never. Like, there's no other restrictions on it. But right now, it's only for those reader apps. My proposal would be allow all apps except games to use that exception.
Well, that's a good answer.
With a few modifications. So you would still have the ability to link out, just like the current system. You would have to apply and get that entitlement so Apple can track it and look at it and make sure it works the way they want it to. It would still show the scare sheet first, to warn people you're going out to a website, this is not going to be through Apple, etc. You still pay Apple no commissions on those sales. What I would modify, besides what apps are allowed to use it, would be remove the restrictions on the URL being a single URL. Let it have a query parameter. I don't care. Remove the restrictions on the language around the UI of the URL. Let people say, create an account on our website and save money. Whatever. They already can't use IAP. And then the only thing I would say is I would retain, though, the one rule that requires part of the reader exception rule now is you are required to use the StoreKit API to check to see if purchases are enabled on the device. Because there are situations like if you have a device for a young kid where a lot of times parents will use the parental controls to disable in-app purchase for that device entirely just to keep the kid from getting in trouble. So that is one feature that makes sense. Other than that, remove all the restrictions on how it needs to be designed, all the not being able to tell people you can go make a purchase here. Just let all apps choose if they want to link out using the scare sheet and using this framework. And they would still have the trade-off of then not supporting Apple's in-app purchase system, because that wouldn't be allowed anymore. But fine, if apps want to choose that, that's fine. And by not letting games do it, by letting all other apps do it except games, you remove a huge amount of anti-competitive, you know, accusations and regulatory pressure from them, because most types of businesses that are being worst affected by Apple's in-app purchase policies and taxes would then have this major relief valve to get out if they want to. And then by not letting games do it, you keep the vast majority of your services revenue, because it turns out, as we've learned from various court cases and disclosures, it turns out that the huge vast majority, I think it was like 87% according to a court case like a year or two ago, the vast majority of Apple's in-app purchase tax revenue is from games. It's not like the Netflixes of the world, because most of them don't use in-app purchase anymore anyway. So it's not, they wouldn't even lose that much from this, because the actual revenue they make is mostly game-based. So if you did this and let all apps use this if they wanted to with those trade-offs, I think you really lift a lot of the pressure off Apple in terms of all the scrutiny of this, and you give up almost no revenue.
That's also a very, very good answer. I think
that's
that.
Not very magic wandy, and I'm not sure which legal problem it's solving. You could say it's solving the anti-steering thing, but in a different way, but Apple would say they already solved the anti-steering thing, but
only Apple believes that.
Yeah. Well, so I'm going to use that same loophole to say that the one legal problem I would solve is the DMA. And you would say, well, Apple already solved that. Well, we don't have a ruling on that yet. Apple thinks they solved it. Jury's still out, but it's not a jury. Anyway, so I'm going to pick the DMA, and I would magic wand that one. And the reason I would is because I think that is the most comprehensive legal challenge they face, because it gets at the, as I said before, it gets at the heart of the issue, which is like, there's not enough competition, and this is trying to restore that competition, and that is a legal problem for Apple, because Apple doesn't want to do that. That's the one I would magic wand. How I would magic wand it, to since both of you offered solutions, especially Marco, with more details, I would say essentially realign incentives within Apple to make your digital marketplace, the App Store, compete based on the quality of the marketplace, as opposed to competing because it's, you know, because you make rules that make it so that you always win or that you have an advantage and all that other stuff, whatever. So open the marketplace up, run your own app store, not at break even, but do the Marco thing of like almost no commissions for anybody except for games because they can tolerate it, and compete based on what you have going for you. It's, I mean, including some of the things that only the App Store can do, but mostly do it based on like, look, you're not going to go to another store because your commissions are low. We basically do it at cost. We just charge for the, you know, our payment processing thing is 30%. How about 3% for everybody except for you games? In-app purchase is a good system. No restrictions on what you can do. You can make your own awesome system. You can link out whatever, but we think you'll use ours because it's good. Oh, you don't. You want some features from in-app purchase? You want better features on App Store Connect? We'll compete based on that. Compete. Like, I think Apple would still win that competition, A, because they have such a huge head start with historical, like, the historical momentum of what people expect from that platform, that they could coast on not only being a little bit better for years, but B, realign your incentives. Everyone working on the App Store should have third-party app stores that they look at and say, we need to make our store better than those stores for consumers and developers by doing things that people like. Not by applying rules to them to tell them they can't do things that developers like. They can't do things that customers like because we won't let them. How about we do things that developers and customers like to keep the 100% market share we currently have? And yes, some of the market share would bleed out or whatever, but like that's the legal problem that I would solve. And I would solve it by like, it sounds from Apple's today's Apple perspective, they say, what, do you mean give up? I'm like, if that's how you have to say it to yourself, yeah. But basically like, you know, I'm not saying run the App Store at break even, like you can still get your money from games because I think they will tolerate that, but make your App Store, your internet purchase, your payment processing, your stuff win because they are the best for consumers and developers, not because you forbid anyone else from doing anything better than you.
I dig both of those. Those are very well done.
Yeah.
Titles.
All right.
I have a favorite, and I suggested it. It's got to be it.
Oh, coming in strong. Colorful Criticism? Why is that your favorite?
Boom. Colorful criticism. Schiller goes through. So, you hurt our feelings and you said we're hot garbage. And you said all these mean things about us. And then he says, you're colorful criticism. Colorful. And we just complained about Apple the whole show. So it's half the show. Colorful criticism. I can't say it, but I want it to be the title.
That's pretty good.
That is pretty good. Let me look at the rest. But I think
like
that's
put me on aux, but it ruins the joke, so we can't use that.
And yeah, also there's some debate whether it's the particular phrasing of where the aux goes or who's on it or who uses it or who's past it.
Yeah.
So I'm just looking at the rest. I think you are the right. I think that's going to be the winner. But
I really can't say it. Colorful criticism. It's a tongue twister.
Jam Band Dad is good, but it's a throwaway thing, and Colorful Criticism is better, but it is a good one. I had suggested. I didn't realize.
Schiller gets the title.
Yeah.
Circle gets the square. That's a reference, John. All right. Colorful Criticism. It's going to be it.
Yep.
And plus, it'll piss off all the Europeans, which is kind of funny. Or I know, I'm sorry, the Brits, which are not Europeans anymore.
Oh, because of we're not. We don't care about their spellings.
Just think all everything they're missing out on now by not being in the EU. They're missing out on all these alternative stores.
Yeah, they still got their own weird words. Don't worry about it.
They have alternative words. Rectus last night
about, I'm not going to spoil it, but a thing that I thought was people just mispronouncing something turns out to be yet another thing that's different in the UK because they just kind of screw everything up.
I'm already excited. I'm excited to hear that in 7 weeks when you two finally post it.
I love how the two of you
uh-oh,
care so much more about UK versus US differences than almost anyone else on earth.
I just find it fascinating.
It's the narcissism of small differences. We're so close, but the tiny things that are different are annoying.
Yep.
And plus, I'm watching a UK reality TV show, so I'm constantly subjected to all sorts of... And I've really thought about this, like, why is this happening now? Because I'd watched things from the UK my whole life, like British movies, the series that are shot there. But like in like scripts for movies and TV shows, that's different than how real people talk. And reality shows, for all their warts, they just get a bunch of people who aren't actors and they just put them in front of the camera. They're talking. And this is the first time I feel like I'm hearing citizens of the UK who are not actors, who are not reading scripts, just talk the way they talk. And I'm just learning so much and hating a lot of it.
All right.
What Brits do I hear? I hear Mike, right? But we've so Americanized him by overwhelming him with our Americanness that we're like converting him. And then I hear Gray, who has been unfortunately sucked into some Britishisms that he says. But in general, that's it. That's my only. That was my only previous exposure, constant exposure to UK folks talking.
All right.
We don't have Top Gear anymore, so what are we going to do?
I know.
Even that, I feel like it's more sort of like mannered and just like not representative of just a bunch of people off the street talking, you know?
Yeah. All right, bedtime?
Yep.
All right, goodbye, live people.
Thanks
for being
this
live people.
This has been fun, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye.